Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Wow! Out of sight! This is fantastic! When did you paint this, JJ?
What?
This!
Oh, last week.
What is it?
I call it Black Jesus.
Black Jesus? Now, this is what the brothers need. Groovy, super, heavy.
Relax, Michael. It's only a painting, not the second coming.
Michael, what's happening? Nothing. Hey, Dom, how you like this? What is it? Don't show your ignorance. This is Black Jesus. Black Jesus, my foot. That's never wino. You mean the dude who's always walking up and down the street drinking wine and preaching? Never wino, better known as the ghetto prophet. Yeah, he's always predicting the end of the world and asking for a dime for some wine so he can die happy.
Which he does every night.
JJ, you sure know how to pick your models or wino Jesus.
It's only a symbol of Jesus.
Hey, JJ, you should introduce him to the exhibit.
No way. Now, Sweet Daddy Williams here is one of a kind. Just a few finishing touches, and he's gonna be ready for Black History.
Sure is a shame to keep this in the closet. Hey, since both are just symbols of Jesus, a Black family should have a Black symbol.
If Mama sees that there, she's gonna kill you.
Nope.
Jesus may have your soul, but Mama gonna have your behind.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade, another program. This would be program number two on the day, attempting to be on the counter-racist grind as often as possible. And definitely want to thank a loyal listener and investor supporting the program. I got more than one copy of the work. Our guest today, books that he's written from folks who helped out, supported, and got me books that I wanted. And hopefully it will be constructive. Your investment will pay off and benefit hopefully a whole lot of Black people and non-white people listening to the program. I hope you will keep that sound clip in mind as we move forward from Good Times. We'll make sure to incorporate that and, you know, break down why that's relevant to our discussion today. Our guest for this evening's program, and today's date, February 3rd, Thursday, February 3rd, 2011. Our guest, he writes for Full Surface Publishing. He is considered by many to be an expert on many issues dealing with African Americans, particularly the U.S. criminal justice system as it relates to Black males. Since the release of his 2007 debut book, our guest has been crisscrossing the states, speaking, networking, and raising national awareness about the crisis of the African American male. He's authored several really important books, all dealing with Black males and problems that we face as a result of racism, white supremacy, one of his books, Why Are So Many Black Men in Prison? Another one of his books, Getting Out and Staying Out, A Black Man's Guide to Success After Prison. The book we will be discussing this evening, The Top 25 Things Black Folks Do That We Need to Stop. Excellent read, and as you can see, expecting racism, white to magically disappear, that is in the top 25. Real pleasure to have our guest with us this evening, coming live from Memphis, Tennessee, our guest, Mr. D'Amico Booth. Mr. Booth, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you, brother?
Oh, I'm doing as well as can be under white domination. How are you, sir?
Well, I would have to say the same, brother.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Thursday evening with us. Real pleasure to get you on the program. For any of my folks who are listening who they're not familiar with your work, if they haven't read some of your material, could you share a little bit more about who you are and the work that you do?
Well, really, I'm just the average common guy who served 13 years in prison unjustly, and I decided to do something about it, and I found my voice with the pen and the paper. I actually wrote my first book while serving time in prison. And since then, I've, you know, gone on to do much more than that. But, you know, I'm just an average, everyday black man that's just trying to make it and trying to help my people and, you know, to become more enlightened on things that, you know, I happen to be enlightened on or am becoming enlightened on as I go, as I live every day. You know, so I'm just the average, everyday black man, brother, and, you know, I'm just trying to be of some service to my people.
Understood. Before we hop into your book, this program, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms, and I have the exact same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
Most definitely. I would have to agree with that definition. Anyone who does not think that the system of white supremacy is real could not be utilizing the brain in their head.
Well said. Well said. I want to hop right into the book, see if we can cover as much material as possible. And suggestions, I love that you say that in the book, or that's rather how you end the book, that more than anything, you just want people to think. And you emphasize, you're just talking to black people. You want them to think about what you said and, you know, come to their own conclusions about what's happening. Obviously, for this program, Context of White Supremacy, it would be great. I would love to start with number 11 on your list of top 25, expecting racism to magically disappear. Can you share your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, you know, looking back through history and looking at the present, I think that we as a people have some sort of desire for racism to disappear magically. You know, it's like we really don't understand it, even though we've been victims of it for centuries. You know, or we act like we don't understand it, or we, you know, act like we don't want to understand it. But it's real every day in every black person's life on this planet. You know, and as you know, as I move among my people and talk with my people, I find that to be a common sentiment or a common desire. You know, that we would wish for racism, we'll delude ourselves even to believe that racism is dying or it's not what it really is, and find excuses not to confront it in the ways that we need to confront it. You know, so that's why I included that chapter and put it at number 11, because I think that's a mentality that, you know, that is very, very pervasive. And, you know, we need to confront it and deal with it, because it's not going to disappear. It is, in my opinion, somewhat natural when it comes to who we're dealing with. You know, and I can bag that up with all kinds of history and go back all throughout time. Dealing with Europeans, it has always been the same sort of situation when it comes to blacks and non-whites. You know, so we have to take that in regard. We cannot forget the lessons of history, you know, because they are what they are. So we must learn from them and build upon those lessons and not ignore them. And, you know, and to me that's a very cowardly thing to do, to try to ignore that which oppresses you the most. You know, and I think that too many of us try to do that. So that's, you know, that's why I put that in the book.
You have on page 104, you write, "It's a true statement that there is not one black person in all of America, and I would say the world, the known universe, and possibly the whole world, who is considered rich and powerful," in quotes, "who did not get those riches and that power through the white-owned system, or who does not answer to a white person in some form or fashion." Very important statement, and I think that, to me, that is the fundamental nature of racism, white supremacy on this planet. And I think if you, as Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. says, if you do not understand racism, white supremacy, everything else that you do understand will confuse you. And I just wanted to ask, do you think that there are a lot of people who understand that statement I just read who just lie to themselves about that?
I think so. I think that's just, you know, for lack of a more technical term, I think that's just a cowardly way to go, you know, because to go the cowardly way is the easiest way. And too many of us have chosen that way throughout, you know, time, you know, and I think that goes to also the root of our problem. Of course, white supremacy, white domination, white oppression, the whole white mentality is the primary problem. But we have to look at how we react to that. You know, are we going to take a cowardly way out, or are we going to, you know, stand up and do what we know we need to do in order to relieve ourselves of this oppression, because it's been too long standing, you know? And I find that to be one of the main catalysts of our oppression, you know, the way that we react to white supremacy, you know, and it starts with how we think. And of course, you think in terms of actions, and too many of us think about white supremacy or don't think about white supremacy the right way. You know, and that's very problematic. You know, we have to deal with it and talk frankly about it. You know, when we are amongst ourselves, when we hear other brothers and sisters say certain things that we know aren't right, but just, you know, like I heard in the beginning when this program came on, you know, it was talking about, the commentary was about, are you tired of smiling when nothing is funny? Are you tired of laughing, you know, or going along with the program when you really don't want to, basically? You know, and that's something we all, as colored people or black people, non-white people, whatever you want to call us, that's something we all have to deal with. Whatever continent you're on, you know, whatever you're doing in life, we all have to deal with that. And we have to figure out a way to alleviate ourselves of that. If we're going to, you know, talk about anything, if we're going to do anything, that's what we should be focused on.
Wow. I was thinking, I had an order laid out, but I'm going to veer from that a little bit, because I think, at least my opinion, and I was curious to get your thoughts on it. When you start to lie to yourself, about racism, white supremacy, and you're not being honest about that, I think one of the delusions that leads into is number 20, spending too much money on clothing, entertainment, and other non-appreciating items. And in that particular portion of the book, I got on page 192 here, you were writing, I'll read a little bit of what you wrote. I believe you were talking about the phrase conspicuous consumption, and I think anyone out there, if you're a reader, Black Bourgeoisie, E. Franklin Frazier, he does a phenomenal job of breaking down this concept of conspicuous consumption and how this is a response to racism, white supremacy. But on page 192 of Mr. Booth's book, he's talking about this concept, and he says, I believe another phrase they used in the report to describe this particular aspect of the behavior was visible consumption. In other words, what their study showed is that, yes, blacks do waste much more of their disposable income than whites of comparable means, and that the reason blacks spend so much of their money on things like expensive name brand clothing, cars and car fixtures, and jewelry is so that they can be seen by other blacks and thought of as having status or wealth. Incidentally, the study also showed that many blacks do the same when it comes to housing. Many times we will buy more house than we actually need, and we will overextend ourselves to be able to own a house that we really cannot afford. I just wanted to get your thoughts, because I think this is one of the things that can happen when you are not honest about racism. Does that make sense?
Of course. Of course. It's a direct reaction to racism and the effects thereof. And it's very commonplace. You know, I can't even, if I tried to name or list all the people in my own family who have done exactly what you just described from my book, that list would be fairly long. You know, it's a big mindset. It's a mindset that is old, and it resonates throughout our entire being. You know, and we have to really confront ourselves when we see ourselves and see others around us doing certain things. You know, we have to ask why. You know, we have to think about what we do and why we do them, you know, and how it applies to us as black people, because make no mistake about it, we have to do for ourselves. We have to think in that capacity, because if we don't, who will? You know, but we have to be strong in that too. You know, and you know, that chapter that I wrote dealing with that issue, you know, it really hits our pockets heavy, even though, you know, the answer to our problem is not, you know, solely through finances or anything dealing with economics, because the bottom line is the pieces of paper that we consider to be valuable have slave masters' faces on them. They control them. They print them. You know, at any given day, it could become worthless pieces of paper. You know, we have to start thinking in a whole grander, you know, capacity about what it is we're doing and why we're doing it as it relates to us. You know, when it comes down to housing, when it comes down to buying a pair of sneakers, you know, because it's all relevant. You know, and there's too many of us don't understand that. You know, we don't understand that, or we don't react like we don't understand how relevant it is, and, you know, the things that we do when it comes to our purchasing power and, you know, the psychology behind why we do it.
Again, our guest for this evening's program, Mr. D'Amico Booth. in the same chapter on spending too much money on clothing, entertainment, and other non-appreciating items, you write that, I cannot count the number of times I have seen brothers in the projects where the rent is only around $200 or $300 with different polo and Gucci designer outfits on every day of the week that cost $300 and sneakers that cost $150. Mr. Fuller, I've heard quite a few folks who have talked about how black people were in these terrible conditions, terrible neighborhoods, and we will go out and do all of this purchasing to try to mask the fact that we are hurting so much and being so victimized. You have solutions, which I love in the book. Do you have solutions on how we can be a little more miserly with our spending?
Well, I would just say, you know, to educate yourself and understand the power of, you know, money under the current system, under the current operating system that we're all in. You know, understand that businesses are owned by people, you know, and I know that's a simple thing to say, but it seems like so many of us look at businesses as if they are just entities of themselves, but no, they make particular people's bank accounts large. You know, they give power to people and to groups of people. So when you spend your $150, it's not just you spending, it's thousands and millions of us spending that $150 for that pair of tennis shoes or for that sweater or for that pair of jeans, $500 jeans. I remember that there was a fad a few years back, $550 Evisu jeans, and I saw brothers everywhere with those jeans, brothers that didn't have cars, you know, and now they're not even in style anymore. You know, if you're seen wearing them, you're looked at as, you know, you're behind trend. So, I mean, you know, this is over and over and over and over again, you know, in our communities. We have to recognize that those are power plays, actually. You know, those are power plays on our pockets, and we have to see them as such. You know, your money is just like your gun, you know, you know, under the current operating system, economic system that we're all in right now, you know, it is power and it can be used better, you know, to benefit us. And we should be thinking in that capacity. So that was my, you know, basic, you know, solution when it comes to how we spend those pieces of paper with those white men's faces on them.
I would agree wholeheartedly. I think if we had a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, and really the phrase that I read earlier where you said, you know, just understanding that we are all answering to white people, I think if we had a better understanding of that, we would do better, and we would do much better with the way we spend our money that white people print and put their picture on.
Mm-hmm.
The next one, I think 10 and 11 are linked, and they're right together. In the book, number 10, expecting white folks to solve our problems for us. And this is on page 103. Great analogy. I want to read this and get you to elaborate. You said that every animal species known to man is self-sufficient in that each species protects itself and provides for itself and knows clearly who its enemies are. And, I mean, beautifully captures the problem in expecting white folks to solve our problems. Could you elaborate, Mr. Booth?
Well, of course. I think we entertain too readily powerless actions, you know, such as marching. Such as trying to co-op our movements with the enemy. How can you possibly expect to succeed doing that? Do you really expect to succeed, or what are you really expecting from such a move? And, you know, throughout history, we've done that too many times, and it's like we don't want to really confront what we really have to do. If we want what we say we want, if we want to be free of the auspices of white supremacy, and as you said, as we all know, this is a global system. This is not a local system. This is not a regional system. This is a global system. You know, we've had world wars before, you know, and the reasons for those world wars really do not even stand up to the reasonings that we have as black people to entertain what we really need to entertain, starting with the continent of Africa, in order to free ourselves from the auspices of white supremacy. If we don't, we'll continue to just prolong and enlarge the game plan of our enemies, because they are our enemies. Make no mistake about that. White people, in plain language, white people, Europeans, are the enemies of black people, of brown people, and have been for a very, very long time. You know, and so many of us act like we want to ignore that. We want to co-opt everything we do with our proven enemies, you know. And I'm just tired of it. You know, I try not to do it at any given, you know, at any time in my personal life. You know, I don't deal with white people in business, you know, and nothing really. You know, if I am, it's because it's a big check involved. Other than that, you know, that's my message. And I think more black people need to think like that. We need to think more independently. We don't need them. But if we think we do, then we do. And until we wake up and realize that we don't, but with that responsibility carries comes more responsibility, you know, comes more options and more things you'll have to consider in order to maintain that freedom and independence, because it's not just going to come your way and stay your way. You know, when you look throughout history, anyone who has ever attained any kind of independence, there was a road they had to take to get that independence. And it's like too many of us are afraid to even think about taking that road, much less taking that road, you know, starting with continental Africa. You know, it befuddles me how white people can have so much power even there. You know, how is it that they allow that? You know, plain and simple, how is it that they allow that? I mean, how we talk about how they trick us and how they do this and how they do, okay, how are we going to react? You know, I hear so many of us talk about how great we are as black people. Okay, well, let's show our greatness. You know, we are gods and we're this and we're that. Let's show the world that. You know, and quit groveling and talking about it and this and that and this and allowing for oppression, because we don't have to allow for it. Allow, you know, but so many of us seem not to want to even consider that and think about what we really need to be thinking about. You know, but we'll talk about white supremacy. We'll do this and do. We'll react to it, but we don't react to it in the correct and proper way. And we haven't for a very long time. You know, not enough of us anyway.
Oh, context of white supremacy. And again, I think these are very much related in terms of failure to recognize white people as our enemies, bitter enemies. You have, this is from the chapter Worshiping and Displaying White Depictions of God and Jesus. You write, for blacks to really and wholly accept these images, especially while under enslavement and oppression by whites, is similar to cats accepting the image of a dog as their god figure and then teaching their little kittens to believe the same. It is a very visible characteristic of a psychologically conquered people that they would worship depictions of God in the form of a person that is not of themselves in the first place, much less that of their most overt oppressor. Do you care to elaborate?
Well, you know, I mean, it's we all see it. We see it every day. You know, I deal with it with my immediate family. You know, the psychology behind it is so powerful that, you know, you could bring storehouses of knowledge and information and facts to those who, you know, are not ready to throw off the mental shackles, and it does not matter. You know, and of course you see brothers and sisters everywhere waking up. Yeah, a lot of brothers and sisters waking up to the truths involving, you know, that whole religious question, specifically Christianity, and how it applies to us as black people under oppression. But, you know, I don't see enough of it. You know, I see some of it, but it's like even the people that I deal with, I try to reach them through any means I can. And you know, I get hit upside the head, you know, with stone walls 99% of the time. You know, it's like we bought into it so thoroughly, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, that, you know, it may take centuries to sufficiently alleviate our people of this mental shackle, and, you know, with the religion we call Christianity. It's a powerful, powerful, powerful psychological tool, and it's been used to, you know, its best capacity. You know, so we have a lot of work to do when it comes to that. But honestly, Gus, I have to say, I just don't understand how you can give someone factual information. You can take someone to King James' grave and let his people tell you about him and what he did, and let them tell you about the religion of Christianity, how it came to be, and all of that. And so many of us will still say, so what? You know, like, we really don't understand how that fits into white supremacy, how it fits into what our people have been going through for so long now. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's I don't know what you know, the answer is for that type that I'm describing, but it's so many of us that are like that. You know, so, you know, bottom line is we just all have more work to do with educating our people. I like the work that the brother Jeremiah Camara is doing when it comes to that. I know you've heard of him. He's the author of the book Holy Lockdown.
Oh, he was a guest on the program Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
He was a guest. Yeah, he's great. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, but yeah, I like the work that brother's doing. But, you know, I guess we just all have to do more work when it comes to that, because it's very, very important. And I like how you had the scene from Good Times. I wrote about that scene actually in the book, The Top 25 Things, because, you know, that was a very, very enlightening scene. Some people, I'm sure, that scene made them think. You know, and if we start to think enough and start to challenge each other on a daily basis to think, you know, think about that which we do, then, you know, we'll stand a better chance of waking up more people, I guess.
Yeah, that I had seen that episode of Good Times when I was a lot more confused about racism. Mm-hmm. But I was reading your book, and you wrote about that scene, and I went back and watched the episode. And it was stunning, just showing, I think, Florida Evans, played by Esther Roll, showing her character and how she responded. I mean, she is furious. She's ready to beat up everybody. And they didn't even take white Jesus down. They just put black Jesus up next to white Jesus, and she flips out. And it's funny because I think my mom, my grandmother, I mean, I think 99.9% of the black people in my family, they would have done the exact same thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I have people in my family who have done the same thing. You know, I'll tell you, I come over some of my kinfolk's houses, and, you know, they still have the white Jesus up. And, you know, I'll just go on a rampage, you know, about, you know, and try to give them the knowledge and understanding of what, and I do that continuously. But still, you know, on the 4th of July, I come over, they got the flags up, they barbecuing, they got the white Jesus all through the house, you know. And that's commonplace, you know. I don't know about New York where you are, but I know it's commonplace where I am, you know. So we have a lot of work to do when it comes to that, brother.
Man, I'm in Seattle, Washington, by the way. just to clarify,
okay.
I'm not in New York. I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Oh, okay.
No worries. The thing that jumped out at me, and that's why I played the clip that I did in that episode. What did you think of JJ? He draws this image of Black Jesus, and the person that he used to model is Ned the Wino. What are your thoughts on that?
I thought it was proper, actually, because Ned was the lowest of the low. You know, humble. When I say low, I really mean humble. So, you know, I really didn't, I guess, give too much aesthetic thought to it. But I think, you know, when I'm thinking about it now, it was proper and fitting if we're going to talk about someone who supposedly was for the people, you know, but actually in the Bible, Jesus was for Jewish people, but that's a whole other topic. But, you know, if you're a black person, you're thinking that Jesus was for the people, then, you know, Jesus should, of course, be someone of lowly status. You know, not necessarily a bum or a wino, but the concept of a lowly person. Hello.
Interesting. I thought that. Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm here. Yeah, I thought that was. It stood out to me quite a bit. It stands out to the characters, like the ones who notice it. Like they seem kind of bent out of shape. You would go and grab Ned the Wino to do this. For folks, if you want to watch the whole episode, I put it in the description. It's pretty interesting. I think you'll learn quite a bit. But yeah, that adds to their anger that not only have they put up this darkened Jesus that, you know, it's modeled on Ned the Wino, that's just way too much. But
Ned is not worthy, huh?
Yeah,
place.
Certainly not. I mean, it's not only is it a black person, but some wino black person. I mean, are you serious? Like, she said it was blasphemy. It's incredible. But, I mean, to be expected under a system of white supremacy, I thought that was a lot of the humor of the episode, showing how we've been, you know, brain-trashed by white people. I was just curious, because you're in Tennessee. Are you familiar with Tim Wise? We were on the subject of Jesus. Tim Wise, the white guy who talks about racism?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of his books, and I've heard a couple of his speeches or sermons or whatever you want to call them on YouTube. That's about it.
Do you think, hey, this is a white guy who, you know, is different? This is a white guy that we should trust, and this is a white guy that's really working against racism?
Well, you know, sometimes if you listen to him, this is what I gather with him. If you listen to him, you know, he says some true things that, and he puts it in a way that I guess, you know, some people can relate to. But what really pisses me off, if you will, is the fact that the man is making more money than and getting more attention, not for the right reasons, mind you, than brothers out here who have been victims of white supremacy, who are doing the exact thing he's doing, trying to enlighten people, which, you know, I'm not really sold on the fact that that's what he's trying to do, you know, because I don't, you know, I honestly don't trust white people when I see them doing things like that, especially, but at any given time anyway. But, you know, that gets under my skin a lot, you know, and it makes me, you know, wonder about the motivations. You know, he's one of these white folks that wants to try to speak to it in a proper way and maybe wake some of his people up. Maybe that's what's in his heart. I can't speak to what's in his heart. But I can speak to what, you know, history and my experiences would lend me to think with credibility, and that, you know, I don't trust them. Any white person that I see talking about white supremacy and catering in a certain way to black folks, something about it just doesn't strike me as correct and proper. Let us do that. If you want to help us, if you seriously want to help us, keep your mouth closed, use your pocketbook, you know, do it where it counts. Running around here speaking, because we can talk about it, we can't really do it where it counts. We don't have, you know, money, we don't have powerful friends and people, you know, we don't know people with money. We can't really use the system of white supremacy to help black people. You know, we and in whatever ways that's possible, we can't do that. We're not a part of the system. But, you know, anybody that's white, if you want to help black folks out, just generally speaking, do it in a way that counts, you know. So I'm not sure Tim Wise is doing that. What do you think?
Tim Wise, he's been a guest on this program about 6 times, and he mistreated a 10-year-old non-white female who asked him if he was a racist. He got an attitude with her and wouldn't answer her question. Are you familiar with Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing? She wrote the ISIS papers?
Yes, yes.
Okay. He referenced her work as pseudo-scientific bullshit. He wrote me a letter and said that. And I asked him about it on the program. He admitted it. And this is recorded, so, you know, I can play a sound clip back of all this. But he referenced her work as pseudo-scientific bullshit. He admitted to being a racist on the program. I take him at his word. He is an admitted racist. I believe him, and I do not think at any time he deviates from that. Even when he's talking about how bad white people are and racism is so tough and black people get such a bad break, even then, I think he's practicing racism.
He's a racist?
Yes, sir. He admitted it. He doesn't do that when he goes out and gives his talks where he can make thousands of dollars. But on this program, yes, he admitted to being a racist.
Wow. Well, you know, at least he's telling the truth.
Yeah. The I thought you said you said sermons. You used the term sermons when you talked about his work. Why did you reference them as sermons?
Because I see a preacher aesthetic. To some of the clips that I've seen him speaking to black folks, I see somewhat of a preacher aspect. Maybe it's just me, you know, maybe I'm looking at him through a suspicious lens, I don't know, but, you know, I see a little of that thrown into the way, you know, his diction and all of that, you know. So, you know, I just don't trust people like white people that go around talking about black issues in a way as if they're trying to enlighten white folks, really. You know, you can do that in private. You know, let us do that. You know, if there's some money to be made from that, let us make it. We need it. You don't need it. You have all the means through the white supremacy system that you are a part of, admittedly, I guess, you know, to do those things. And, you know, if you want to help us do it in a back alley type of way. We don't need you out front, you know, talking about white supremacy as if you are not a part of the problem. You know, that's just how I see it. You know, maybe it's a simplified way of looking at it, but that's just how I see it.
It sounds very logical to me. And he even said, that's one thing he did admit, you are correct to view him with suspicion. He said that more than once. He said that is totally logical, it makes sense, and that all non-white people should be suspicious of him and any other white person. So I think you're doing the correct thing. And I think he's catering to black people to try to spread that confusion and confuse us into thinking that white people, there might be some white people who are looking to help solve our problems and improve things for us. And I'm in agreement with you. We need to be getting away from that.
Of course. I mean, the white person I put out front as an example of, if you're white and you want to do something, the white person I put out front is John Brown, you know, because he didn't talk about it, he did it. If there's talking about it that needs to be done, let us do that. If there's doing it that needs to be done, let us primarily do that too. But if you want to help on the doing part, don't help on the talking part. We don't need to hear nothing you really got to say, especially if you're admitting that you are a part of the problem. You know, okay, you're speaking truths that we all really know, so why are we catering to you? Why are we buying your books? You know, everything you're saying, we really already know. We may not be able to, put it in articulate fashions, all of us or what have you, but we know. You know, and those of us who are out here that are trying to, you know, keep the struggle up, keep the fire lit, inform our people, awaken our people, we really know. So we don't need you along with us doing what we're doing. You know, let us do that and awaken our people and deal with that. You want to help us, dig in your pockets, ask your friends to dig in your pockets and donate something, and keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. And we'll thank you for that. You know, that's just the way I look at it, Gus.
I love it. Again, our guest, he is the author of the top 25 things black folks do that we need to stop, Mr. D'Amico Booth. And you can check their website. It is FullSurfacePublishing.com. FullSurfacePublishing.com. You can click D'Amico Booth's name, and it will take you to their website. You touch on, this is number 23, we should stop celebrating holidays like the 4th of July and Thanksgiving. And this is on page 225. There is no autonomously powerful group of people of one racial makeup who massively celebrate the holidays of another racial group unless they have been conquered by that group. You want to share your thoughts on this chapter?
Well, yeah, it just speaks to the whole question of why is it that we as black people, even in times where we have a certain amount of what some would say freedom of choice, why would we still not understand that everything that we've been under oppression? So from our languages to to everything that we do, our culture, all of it must be questioned. You know, the holidays we celebrate, the things that we do on a daily basis, we must understand why we do these things and, you know, evaluate them as to the worthiness of them in our lives as black people. You know thyself. If you don't know who you are, then anything around you won't, nothing around you will make sense. You will misuse and abuse and misapply everything around you if you don't know who you are. And too many of us don't know who we are and don't want to know, it seems, who we are and how everything around us applies. These holidays that we celebrate as a people, they're not ours, you know, just to put it simple and plain. They're not ours. They were not created for us. The 4th of July, our people were enslaved. You know, we're still enslaved. We don't have independence and freedom, so why are we celebrating independence and freedom? We don't even know what that is, you know. And if you want to get technical with it, you can pick up any book, go to any library, you can Google it. You can see what the origin of these days are, the 4th of July, all of these days, Christmas, all of that, St. Patrick's Day. You know, we need to know, we need to start to think and understand everything that we do has a meaning and a purpose. Everything is everything, like Lauryn Hill said. Everything is related. And in this case, everything is related to white supremacy, to being under oppression, to being second, third, fourth class, second, third, fourth rate, to being the least respected people on the planet, even though we're numerically the majority, to being the least powerful people on the planet, even though we are the most naturally powerful, you know. So all of these things must be understood and properly understood.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. One thing that stood out to me, and I thought it was fantastic, I have said on the program consistently, I think it would be best to try to talk about racism, white supremacy early, often, if you have children, and to not get those holidays started. Once you have celebrated a couple at a young age, I mean, those memories get locked in, and it's real hard to cut that off once you get started. And you had suggestions for people if you already have been doing the Christmas thing and you're maybe trying to wean off and make it more constructive about, okay, if you absolutely got to do this, you can give school supplies or give things that you were going to already get so that, mm-hmm. you know, you still get whatever euphoria you need out of the gift giving and all that stuff. But you don't tell them it's a white Santa Claus and you're getting stuff that you were already going to purchase. I thought that was fantastic. You want to elaborate some more on that, just if you have other suggestions for ways you can deal with it. And if you want to go into more detail specifically about any of the holidays, that would be great, too.
Well, I mean, what I tell my people when I talk to black people just in general and farms and whatnot, I just tell them, you know, to think about that, what you do, and to do the research yourself. You know, when you hear someone who is, especially who is fighting for your causes on your side and talking about what the truths of the world are and of reality, then you take that and you do the research yourself, you learn, you read, you study yourself, you know, and that way you'll gravitate more towards, you know, the truth and what we all know to be the truth when it comes to that. A lot of times when we hear people talking, you know, we'll take that and just, you know, twist it into whatever logic we want to put with it, and there's no growth. You know, so I just, you know, tell my people, look at Thanksgiving. Go and research it and see what it really is about and think about how it applies to you as a black person, how it applies to your ancestors when it was created as a holiday, all the way up until now. Think about St. Patrick's and how that applies to black people. Look it up. You know, the white people, they're not going to lie to you about their stories, and, you know, when it comes to that. You know, they'll tell you what the facts are. You know, when you pick up your Bible and you see King James' name on it, look it up. You know, go and see who he is and see that he's buried between his two homosexual lovers. They'll tell you that. You can go to Europe and see it for yourself. You know, you'll read that he was called Queen James by his own people. You can go all the way back to Alexander the Great, and you know, you can go and pick up the movie Alexander the Great and see for yourself how European rule was instituted into Africa and certain parts of it that's true that, it, you know, still exists to this day in terms of how we are conquered, you know. And you can see how homosexuality and all of that played into that. You know, it's. But all we have to do is start to think for ourselves when it comes to living under oppression. But we have to understand and admit that we are under oppression. I don't know why this is even something we have to talk about, because this is something that we live with every day. Our ancestors live with. We all have been through the struggle and continuously are going through it. You know, it's a shame we even have to keep reiterating we are under oppression, that white people are your enemy. You know, we shouldn't even have to say those words, because those that should be understood with everybody who has brown and black skin. You know, but we, for some reason, you know, we know how white supremacy has miseducated all of us, but it seems to go to a deeper level, though, even more so than that, because many of us just don't want to face up to the truth. You know, in today's world, we all have the capacity to recognize the truth. It's out there for you. Gravitate toward it. But many of us just don't want it for some reason. We don't want to gravitate toward the truth. And maybe that goes into the question of why they chose us as a people in the first place to do this whole slavery thing with. Why they were able to have conferences, European nations were able to have conferences to talk about how they're going to split up continental Africa. You know, that's something that's never been done before, split up a continent without a major war. Maybe that goes into the answering that question, why they chose us in the first place, because many of us just, even today, we don't want to deal with reality. We want to go the soft way out. You know, we want to say that it is something that it's not and say that it's not what it really is. And, you know, I confront black people every day when I see us with that cowardly mentality that is so pervasive, and I'm just calling it what it is. You know, we need to confront each other with that, because as long as that is apparent, we will not get anywhere with this conversation. Will be held by our descendants 100 years from now and 200 years from now. You know, and if we want to really bring an end to it, or start to bring an end to it, or just getting on that right path to bring an end to it and dealing with it properly, then that's what we got to do. We have to confront each other. You know, the worst that can happen is going to happen to you anyway, and that's death. And we have to think about that and understand that.
Context of white supremacy. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I was watching Good Times, and the that episode, part of the plot is when they put up this image of Black Jesus. They start to get all this good luck, and it just makes Florida, she gets more and more angry because she wants to take the Black Jesus down, and she just thinks it's blasphemous, so she gets more and more upset as more good things happen to all of the family members. And James, he comes in the house, and he says, Santa has arrived. And I just thought, oh, we trade in white Jesus, but we got to keep Santa Claus. And you wrote on 223, you were talking about Santa Claus, and you said, other than my beliefs about Christianity in general, my issues with this holiday are twofold. The promotion of the white Santa Claus image to black children, in addition to the white Jesus, God, angels, images that are usually displayed during Christmas season, and the aspect of the holiday that involves materialism and commercialism and the needless spending of money. In a nutshell, I just think that it is deeply psychologically problematic for black children and black babies in this world's reality to imagine that some benevolent white man is going to come down their chimneys and give them anything for free. And I think that if Christmas is about celebrating the birth of Christ as it is supposed to be, why do we all have to go out and get broke trying to buy a bunch of toys and stuff we really can't afford and don't need? Collectively speaking, black folks really don't have a whole lot of money to waste, and oftentimes the stuff we buy our children for Christmas doesn't last more than a month or so afterwards. And I just thought that needs to be repeated like every day from black people.
Of course.
Did you want to comment?
Well, I mean, that said it all. I mean, we have to understand, you know, why is it we do what we're doing? We're basically just following suit, and we're trying to really, you know, we're following suit harder than the suit we're following. I mean, if you understand what I'm saying, you know, like I've heard Jeremiah Camaro say this, something like to the effect of Christian, the Christians, the original Christians, you know, when you're talking about dealing with the European version of Christianity, we out church them. You know, if you're talking about going to church on Sunday, white folks go to church hour and a half, they're gone. We go to church and stay all day, you know, and have all kinds of events, and we take it to a whole new level, a whole different level, and even apply it to our lives in a way that they don't. You know, we use it for spiritual purposes. White folks use it for a different reason. You know, when you really think about it, they conquer in the name of Christianity. That's something black folks would never do with Christianity. We would never conquer in the name of Christianity. You know, but they have done that because that is a tool for them. It always has been. But with us, we connect with it in a spiritual way. And that's, what, you know, part of the reason why we're so spiritual, or I guess if you can use the word spiritually connected to white folks. You know, we are spiritual people, and pretty much everything we do seriously, we invoke, you know, a certain amount of spirituality, you know, into it. And, you know, we go too far with that sometimes. And definitely as it applies to these holidays and these religions and whatnot that we got from our enemies. You know, no one can debate where the origin of these holidays and of these religions. No one can debate that, you know. And, you know, I've had dealings, Gus, with preachers and bishops and whatnot, and they won't even talk about that sort of thing. Even when it comes down to the holidays, they won't even discuss that because they know, but they don't care. They know, but they don't care. If they did know, they would want to have those discussions, you know, if just to learn. Or to teach, or to sway, or be swayed, but they don't even want to have that conversation. So that tells me they're running from something, and that's, you know, like I said, a common characteristic among too many of our people. We run from the truth when it's painful, when it's something we have to confront that involves confrontation, especially confrontation with whites. You know, we'd rather beg and ask rather than take. And that's what needs to be done, bottom line. You know, but we have to work on our understanding of who we are and why we are and where we are. And it's a shame that in 2010 that subject is still, you know, we have to, you know, I know we're just 40, 50 years from, you know, super overt oppression, but it's no excuse. You know, I watched movies from the 70s. You know, you watch the movie Spook That Sat by the Door. Very conscious movie. And, you know, you have brothers and sisters, masses of brothers and sisters today, who don't even have the consciousness that was shown and given in that movie. You know, 30, 40 years later, we're walking around with less knowledge than our ancestors that are long in the grave. You know, dealing with this white supremacy subject, dealing with this oppression, being black under oppression subject. There are certain things that every black person should know. You know, if not even have been taught, just knowing. You know, like, you know, certain things you should just know.
Of course. You shouldn't have to be taught that. Why should anyone have to stand before you and give you a sermon or a speech or give you proof of that which you already know? You know, tap into your third eye, whatever you want to call it. But wake up and use your brain and start thinking, black people, please. Because, you know, things are getting worse. It's not getting better. And, you know, 100, 200, 300, 400 years from now, where are we going to be if things keep going down these lines? Where are we going to be, or do you not care? And too many of us act like we don't care. And that, you know, that's basically what got me involved doing the things I'm doing, because doing time in prison, I really saw that, you know. I really saw that with, you know, my peers and the guys that are serving time with me and with the prison guards, how we think about things, you know. Black prison guards coming to prisons that are in all white states, basically, and the prisons are all black, and you're a minority on the guard force, but you're coming in here acting like you don't see that out of 3,000 prisoners here, 2,700 of them are black. You come in here and you act like you don't see that. You know, and it shows with how you relate to the people in here and with your co and every. It shows with how you do your job that you are ignoring something that you should not dare ignore. You know, that mentality is very problematic, very pervasive with us, Gus.
Did you have interaction with some of these black guards? And specifically, that you know they were just blocking out the fact that, you know, 2,700 out of 3,000 are black males.
Oh, of course, I was known for that. Actually, I was known for that. I would confront them and get sent to the hole sometimes, you know, because it would just make me sick to my stomach, you know, to see some of the things, you know. And people talk about, well, you know, people talk about violent revolution and all this. You know, I've been having this conversation lately with a lot of quote-unquote black power brothers and sisters, you know, the consideration of violent revolution because things have gotten so bad. Well, you may can tell that to someone who's been, you know, been out here every day, all day, but I've been behind these prison walls for 13 years, and I've seen it get as bad as it can get. And I've seen brothers with life sentences, double life sentences, triple life sentences get treated like dogs and animals, and they accept it, get trained, so to speak, to do things that they wouldn't do as men, to accept behavior, to accept treatment that they should dare accept, that they should prefer death over. I've seen it year after year after year. I've wondered, how is it that these brothers who call themselves the Black Guerrilla Family and this, that, and the other, these brothers in here were doing triple life and allowing themselves to be, I mean, of course you're in prison, but there's a certain measure of, you know, treatment that you should not allow, that you should prefer death over. You know, and I've seen it over and over, so I know we haven't reached the bottom yet out here in the free world in terms of how bad it can get. You know, maybe that's what needs to happen in order for most of us to wake up, because that's what it's going to take. It's going to take most of us to have a certain type of mentality, just like you see what's going on in Egypt. You know, most of those people there, they're on a certain accord. You know, they have certain general things they agree on. You know, you have factions and this, that, and the other, but a certain general things they agree on. And you know, we need to have the same thing if we're going to change, you know, our global situation from Haiti to Africa to America, all over the globe. We're going to have to come on one accord in some form or fashion in order to sufficiently deal with the white supremacy and how it affects us.
Wow. Again, our guest, Mr. D'Amico. Number 8 in your book, Marching. I thought it was real interesting that was, and it's early. It's one of the things that you got early stop doing. And you talked about participating in the protests and march in connection with Janus 6. Can you talk about that and why you think black people need to stop marching?
Well, I just don't see anything of substance. I mean, we in certain capacities we've used it properly, I guess. But to look at it as a tool of changing the system of white supremacy, that it is not. And I think that's what we need to be focused on. Anything less than that is just prolonging the situation and ignoring the situation. You know, we need to be focused on action, on how to change the situation as it is right now for our descendants to come. You know, we all need to be focused on that. And marching is just an act of powerless, weak people. I mean, that's just what it is. You know, because you're asking, you're drawing attention, you're begging. That's what you're doing. And you're not even doing that right. You know, like I just spoke on Egypt. Okay, what they did was they mixed some violence with it. That's something we don't do often as black people in this country. But and their demonstrations and whatnot, they were done in a different fashion than the ones we do over here. You know, they were done in a totally different fashion with a totally different goal. You know, we marched to put on a show to say we've done something, to feel like we've done something about a particular situation. But have we really done something about it? Those Gen 6 boys, there are millions of them. Millions of them. So, okay, we march about one situation. What about the other, you know, 980,000 that have happened in the last decade? What about that? What about these laws that are on the books that create the Gen 6s every day? Every day, and destroy their lives. What about that? What are we going to do about that? What about what's going on in Haiti, how we, the military is positioning right now to talk about invading Libya for humanitarian reasons? What about Haiti? What are we going to do about that? How are we going to hold our governments or the people in power? How are we going to hold their feet to the fire on that? Let's talk about that. Or let's just not talk about it and just be victims of white supremacy and, you know, not be concerned with whatever happens and just be happy victims of white supremacy. It's either or, as far as I'm concerned. And so many of us seem to choose the latter, you know, because it's the easiest way. You know, you shut your mouth and do your life and go on about your business. You know, but that, I think that that mentality has to change if we ever stand a chance of sufficiently throwing off the auspices of white supremacy as black people on the planet. You know, and marching is just, it's not going to get it. It's not going to cut it. It looks pretty and all of that, but, you know, that time is over. It's time for, you know, something more than that. We don't use the same tools that our ancestors used. You know, at some point, you know, we go from the horse and buggy to the car. You go from the car to the airplane. You go from the airplane to the jet. You go from the jet to the space center. You know, we still marched in 2010 and 2011. You know, so that's my take on that.
Wow. Number 12 in the book is trying too hard to integrate and assimilate. And this is on page 121. You write, "I love to make similar comparisons and analogies and to juxtapose them to the scenario that I wish to describe in hopes that everyone can clearly see what I'm saying. In this case, imagine if, say, 90% of all white women in America desperately sought to wear their hair in dreads, afros, and cornrows and put their hair through lengthy chemical processes and or gluing procedures every week or every 2 weeks to make it happen, or if 90% of all Asian women did the same. That would be ludicrous, right? We as black people would find that downright hilarious, wouldn't we? We would undoubtedly see that to be misguided, misguided, overzealous attempts by them at being like us in order to be more acceptable to us, wouldn't we? Well, this is the same way that the enlightened members of other races see us when black people do the very same sorts of things with our hair. We just don't see it. Can you elaborate a little bit on this chapter, trying too hard to integrate and assimilate with white people?
Oh, yes. I think many times you can find throughout history and even today, or throughout recent history and even today, you can find many examples of overzealous attempts by us to assimilate and integrate, which means that we know that they don't find us acceptable in our natural forms. And to a certain extent, we agree with that assessment. I'll repeat that. To a certain extent, we agree with that assessment. So we change our appearances. We make whatever changes we feel that they would have us to make and that we want to make anyway, many of us, because we don't like ourselves. We do that in order to further integrate and assimilate. You know, and many times we do it, and we do it with blinders on, because those who don't look like us, they see it clearly for what it is. Make no mistake about it. When they see you with your long perm, and they see you with, with your chopped off nose, they know what you're doing. You know, they know, and they're not just the enlightened ones from the other, you know, other races. You don't have to be that enlightened. They know exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. But many times when you talk to brothers and sisters who do that, they don't know why they're doing it. They think they're doing it to beautify themselves. But those who don't look like us know better. You know, so, you know, this is, of course, you look around every day, all day, every day, you see us who, you know, who do these things, and we don't know why we do them. We do them because we think, you know, like you watch the documentary, Chris Rock, he did an excellent job, the documentary Good Hair, excellent, excellent job in showing how ludicrous, actually, it really is. You know, black people, I think, in this country spend, you know, about 80%, I think it is, of the hair for sale. What's wrong with our hair? But it's like, you know, most of us think something is wrong with our hair. We actually think deep down inside that something is wrong. One of the hardest things to do is to get a sister who's been perming her hair to stop doing it. That's one of the hardest things you ever try to do, Gus. And trust me, I've done it, and I've tried to do it. You know, because it's a fight. It's a mental fight she's going to have with herself about, am I going to be pretty still? Am I still going to like myself? Am I still going to be acceptable to myself and to others with the way I came out of the womb, looking that way? You know, so these discussions we need to have more. We need to confront each other about it. You know, I'm all about confrontation. We need to confront each other about it. Those of us who are, you know, in the know when it comes to certain things, we need to each one teach one. You know, and I don't, when I say confront, I don't mean necessarily in a negative way. It means just bring the subject up, talk about it, discuss it, put it on the table, bring awareness to it, ask questions, you know, give the information you have over and let it simmer and let them walk away with it. You know, it may take them 5 years, but, you know, you never know. So, you know, that's my take on it.
I wanted to go back. I thought that was extremely important, how you began your response. I just want to make sure people heard that. Would you say that it is accurate to the degree that black people continue to perm our hair, straighten our hair, try to color it blonde, mutilate our bodies in order to look like and or be more accepting to white people, the degree to which we continue to do that, that represents the degree to which, at some level, we still kind of agree with white people that, yeah, there is something incorrect about us.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I know it's a hard thing to, you know, it's hard to, you know, to say it sometimes and see it for what it is, but, you know, when you deal with your people daily and you see it and, you know, you keep an objective mind, I mean, it's, you cannot really ignore that fact because, you know, a lot of sisters that I know and brothers even too who have these extensive rituals to do these sort of things, they're not in their mind, they're not comparing themselves to white people. But in their mind, you know, as victims of white supremacy, they think they are improving upon something that needed improving upon. You know, and, you know, that's a deep psychological error, you know, and, you know, we just have to retrain, I guess, or, you know, some kind of way invoke in our people what the truth is and how they've been, I guess, misled, or if you want to, you know, apply that to white supremacy, how they've been misled to think that and believe that. But I think that many of us, we do think that something is wrong with how we look. You know, not just in America, all over the, you know, the world, really. You know, we have this, you know, global white supremacist situation that we're living under, and it has so many arms and levers, and before we're out of the womb good, we're hit with it, you know. So we just have to be who we really are, you know, and take control of our thoughts and our actions and our lives and our environment. And understand we don't have to play into the white supremacy system. We don't have to. It's a choice, really, you know, to a certain degree. You know, certain things you have to do, you know, right now as it stands. You know, I don't think you can make it out here without some greenbacks in your pocket, you know, at some point. But, you know, we have to understand exactly what it is we're doing and how to, you know, navigate through it more, you know, more properly and the best way to bring about the best results for us, you know.
I want to give out the website one more time for folks to support Mr. Booth and Full Surface Publishing. The website fullsurfacepublishing.com. See all of their titles, get more information, contact Mr. Booth if you'd like to bring him to your area, speaker, and to get their book.
I'm going to get ready to hit the phone lines in a hot second. If you want to go ahead and dial in so you can ask Mr. Booth a question or two, the number is 347-215-6071. Press 1 if you have a question. I'll get your line. Very much connected to the previous chapter and our insane rush to imitate and be like white people. This is number nine, getting rich and famous, then marrying white women. And this is directed at black males. And this particular portion really stood out to me because we had a non-white female. She was a guest on the program earlier today, Sharon Hall. She has a white parent. She's not white, but she has a white parent. And she has children with a white man. And she said that her children are light enough that they can be accepted as white. And you write about this in your book on page 94. You said, history shows us that many white European societies in the past, when faced with a problematic or undesirable racial or ethnic minority element within their midst that the powerful majority wanted to decrease in numbers, resorted to outbreeding the minority, thereby over time diluting the distinct physical and cultural differences between the two groups, and at the same time stifling the influx of that minority group from entering in large number into their homeland. There are many examples of this policy being utilized throughout white history. I just wanted to get you to comment on that and the dangers of having sex with white people.
Well, we should understand that we are the prototype, I mean, to really get to the bottom line of it. When you talk about humanity, when you talk about human beings, we are the prototype. Make no mistake about it. We are the best. We have the best potential in any arena to come out on top. That's why we are referred to in many circles as the sleeping lions of Zion, because make no mistake about it, we are the prototype. Why would you want to dilute that? But first you must understand who you are and why you are the prototype. You know, you must understand why is it that they are afraid of us. Why is it that they don't want to be on an even playing field with us? They want to create as much of an uneven playing field, in every arena possible where they deal with us, because they know. They know, but too many of us don't know. We don't know history. We don't know who we are. Know thyself, study who you are, find out who you are, and you'll understand how everything in the environment applies to you. As far as what I refer to as interbreeding, we should understand that that's a very dangerous notion. It's actually a tool and a weapon that is being used against us right now in this country. You know, you wonder why is it that there are less blacks in this country right now than Hispanics. You know, how did that happen? At one point, there were more of us than there were Europeans in this country. Do you think this is by design, or do you think this is just happenstance? Of course, when you look at the immigration policies of this country, when you look at how this country does business with regards to African nations and whatnot, it's clear to anyone that there are goals that are being worked toward. And the race problem, if you want to call it that, has been the biggest, greatest problem this country has ever known. And the powers that be are obviously trying to find a way to easily rid this country of that problem. And they're not going to kill us all. They're not going to send us all back to Africa. So what is the option left? When you study European history, you'll see it's been used time and time again with undesirables who are, you know, who cannot be dealt with in any other way. England used it with France even. You know, it's all about arming yourself with knowledge and knowing what has happened in the past, and you can see what's going on in the present. The result of this, you know, if you ever want to ask yourself, is something right or wrong, ask yourself, what will be the result, the long-term result of this action? You know, if you care about black people, you think about 100 years from now in this country, the way things are right now, at the pace that it's going right now, when you talk about intermarriage, when you talk about all of those things, the black race basically won't exist. There will be no considerations of what our ancestors went through. There'll be nobody here to really remember and to really, you know, represent who we are and what we are, you know, because we'll all be basically, you know, mixed, more or less. You know, when you look around right now, I think I posted something like that on Facebook a few days ago. It's becoming increasingly harder to find a dark-skinned couple in this country. You know, you have to almost go somewhere where there are a lot of immigrants, you know, like Little Haiti or something. But in my city, in Memphis, you know, it's increasingly hard to find two dark-skinned blacks who are not immigrants, who are, you know, when I say immigrants, I mean, you know what I mean, because we're all immigrants, really, but you know, it's becoming increasingly hard to find that. So you fast forward another century or two, and what will be the result of that? You know, and then you have to ask yourself that question, do you want your descendants to be white? And if you are satisfied with that, then, you know, I don't know what to say to you, you know, if that's what you want and desire. But if you care about, you know, your people, if that's something that you are concerned about, which you should be, in my opinion, the presence of your people, having the correct cultural mindset, having the correct, you know, abilities in this environment, even whether this country is here a century or not, or not, you know, do you want your descendants to be Europeans? You know, that's the bottom line. I mean, that's what it results to. If we keep going down this road, that's what it's going to be, because it's more of us than more of them than us here. And, you know, the system of white supremacy will usually push those, like Halle Berry's daughter and the offspring of the young lady you just told me about. It will typically push them to go the other way with it, you know, in other words, to try to pass for white. You know, they may not, but for the most part they will, you know. And I think that's very dangerous.
Hmm. Do you see a relationship between we're talking eugenics and genocide in terms of outbreeding people. Do you see a relationship between that and an increase in so-called homosexual activity, because that also would negatively impact a group's ability to procreate?
Of course, and our acceptance, our over-acceptance of it, actually. You know, it's like we buy lock, stock, and barrel into whatever they promote and over-promote. You know, homosexuality goes back so far in recorded European history. I mean, this has always been a part of their accepted culture for the most part. You know, I don't think you can go back in African history, recorded African history, and find anything similar to that. You know, so, you know, we have to understand from whence it came and how it affects us, you know, and what the long-term results will be in terms of, you know, our acceptance of this as a, you know, something that's natural. And, you know, I've had many discussions with a lot of, I must say mostly sisters, but brothers and sisters, who seem to have bought lock, stock, and barrel into this notion that this is, for the most part, a natural disorder. But when you look at it for what it really is, I think there's no question that for the most part, it is a choice. You know, and it may be completely a choice, but I think there's no question that for the most part, it's a choice. You know, Eddie Long, I don't think he was born desiring penis. You know, this is a choice he's bought into. Tyler Perry, all, you know, I don't want to keep naming it, but I mean, you know, you can go on and on and on. These brothers, they're making a choice to buy into a cultural standard or non-standard that is in no way helpful or healthy for an individual, much less a people.
I agree completely. I definitely want to get this problem corrected immediately, because I do not want things to continue. We might have to have top 26 and have number 26 be stop wearing dresses to black males. So yeah, we need to get on that job. The folks that called in, I want to hit the phone lines. I did want to acknowledge the listener who did the brand new graphics for the show page. They are incredible. Really just, I think, hammer the point home that the problem is white people, and they got the whole world in their hands. Outstanding. Thanks. It's outstanding. Person who called in from a blocked number, your line is open. Did you have a question for?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Good to hear from you.
Hey, Gus. Nice to hear from you again, too, and to the other caller on the line. Hold on. I have to switch phones. My battery's about to go out. Okay. Can you hear me?
Hello? Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And to your guest as well that's on the line. I hope Pam is also on there as well, because I have something I'd like to ask her also later on if she's open, when, if you're open for a discussion. But I have to agree with the guest and what he is stating, that is right on point when he was making the reference about in 100 years or maybe less, what is going to happen to us if we keep breeding at the rate that we are going. Because it makes me very, very uncomfortable, because I see it all the time with these mixed race. I know you don't like to use the word mixed race or biracial, but these non-white parents with children with maybe a one white parent, because I see it all the time when I go to these parties, and everyone always make a big fuss over them. And it irritates me to no end, because I saw it at my niece's birthday party this weekend, how the children of the parents who had one, at least one white parent, or everyone always making a big fuss to make sure that they get seated, they get the cakes, they get the ice cream, and they get treated extra special. And the other children there, they're not, because my niece and my nephew, they're dark complexion. They're the darker youth, because both of my parents, they were darker complexion. And my husband is the same thing. I would say I'm a female. I'm between the complexion of maybe a Michelle Obama and Felicia Rashad. And I've always been attracted to darker male for dates. I never like dated the lighter skinned brothers, because I never felt that they were attractive enough for me. I always like to go darker. So you are right. You don't see too many of them. You always get what is called the salt and pepper. One dark, one light when it comes to black, when you see the coupling. And I always enjoy seeing the darker complexion blacks. So
mm-hmm.
you are right, because my father always pushed us. He always said, I would prefer it if you all go darker.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us went dark except for my brother, because my brother was, like you said, he always had this thing with his complexion. He always went light because his wife was a lighter-skinned female.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, it's the self-hatred that you're seeing, because we see it all the time with the debutante balls, the cotillions, and all of these imitations of the white society that blacks are pushing, these coming-out parties, because they had a couple over this past weekend. I live in Atlanta, and, of course, you know it's supposed to be the so-called black Mecca, where they're always trying to push this society function in the so-called black middle class. And it really and truly irks me, and they can't see that they're trying to be white-like because they have their own black version of what the white society is, and because you're not still accepted by the whites.
Yeah, it's all assimilation. That's all it is. The end result is total and full assimilation. And to fully assimilate is to really, in my opinion, is to spit on your ancestors who have righteously struggled, and who, and those of us who are still struggling righteously against white supremacy. You know, to me, you know, just to put it in simple forms, it's something I always do. Imagine there's a gigantic jungle-wide war between lions and tigers. And the tigers have always won. The tigers have always misused and abused the lions and made them do all the hunting and just serve them. And then you have these lions that want to go and marry into being tigers. I mean, it's just that simple. I mean, why would you want to do that? So now you are supporting your own oppression. That's the bottom line to it. You've become a white supremacist yourself. That's the functionality of your action. You are acting out in a self-destructive way, white supremacy. That's the bottom line.
Wow. caller at 404. Hang tight 1 second. I wanted to get some of the other folks who dialed in really quick who had a question. Other person that dialed in from a blocked number. Did you have a question for Mr. Booth, other person at a blocked number?
I would like to ask the guest, firstly, what do you think the world would be like if there were no non-white people on the earth, but only white people?
I think it would be pretty much the same hell that it is now for many white people. A lot of people don't understand that white people were oppressing each other, not to the extent that they oppressed non-whites, but to a certain measure, they were oppressing each other before they left out of Europe, you know, what we call considered to be the first outings of Europeans from continental Europe. You put that into context with your question. There is a mentality, a cultural mentality, that is pervasive among Europeans, and we can debate about the origin of it, but it's a certain aggressive type of mentality. Maybe it came from the Ice Ages, but, you know, there's a certain pervasive, aggressive mentality and desire to conquer and take and use and utilize wherever it can be done. And that mentality exists, you know, really you can't argue with the fact that it exists more with Europeans than with those of other races, you know. So I would say that the world would still be, you know, I think if white people had come to America and there were other whites there who they could defeat, they would have defeated them. They would have, you know, conquered them. But I don't think they would have treated them with such malice. I don't think you can go throughout history and see anything comparable to how Europeans dealt with Indians and with Africans in European history.
Okay. Thank you. The last question that I have is, what do you think are the weaknesses of the white mindset?
Well, I would say there's a lot of weaknesses, a whole lot of them. Really, I can put it to you in very simple terms. When you have that particular desire to go and to take and to conquer and pillage, and when you have the capacity to do people, human beings, fellow human beings, to find excuses and justifications to do fellow human beings worse than you do your chattel, and to do it as a, to create a culture from doing that, and to spend whole lives and lifetimes doing that, you know, I think that that in itself signifies great weaknesses because, you know, first off, why do you have the desire to do that? What are you overcompensating for? You know, that those are, you know, compensation actions. You know, why, you know, when you want to freeze people out from equal opportunity, you know, you ask yourself, why is it that I want to do that? Why is it that I have to use every tool possible to gain an advantage over others? And no one can argue that this is what Europeans do, this is what white people do. You look at the arms race, there, it really hasn't been a race. Everybody's been trying to catch up with white people because white people have always been the ones, you know, from recent history. When I say recent history, I'm talking about from centuries on back, from centuries on up, have always been the ones trying to get the ups on weaponry, you know, on how to in a cowardly fashion to win wars and to defeat and conquer and pillage. You know, everyone else is playing catch up. So I think that that mentality in itself spawns from weaknesses and desires to overcompensate for weaknesses.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, for the question, excuse me. Thank you for the questions. person who dialed in, got Pam on. Second time today. Good to hear from you, Pam.
Good evening, Gus, and to your guest. I'm listening right now. I did hear 404 say she had a question, so I'll just wait. And I'm listening because I agree with everything. I really don't have anything to add right now, so I'll listen.
Right on. Okie dokie. Let's see. The person who dialed in 5132, did you have a question?
This is Jamal, Mr. Hill. How are you doing today?
Oh, good to hear from you, Mr. Hill.
Yeah.
I am doing as well as I can under the circumstances.
My question to the is this. The question I want to ask is this. I don't know really how to frame it, but this is how it is. The taller you are and the blacker you are, is that some type of fear that white people fear you? I mean, as a male.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. Most definitely, because the fear, it's an, you understand, fear, it comes from, when you're talking about this particular fear, it comes from knowing who they are, knowing who we are, knowing their capacity and knowing our capacity. You know, I can put it to you in very layman terms. In prison, I saw this continuously. I saw this dynamic continuously. And I served time in 9 different prisons all over the country, and I've actually been inside of dozens of prisons. But when white men come to prison, even if they are, in which I've never seen this, but even if they have, a sufficient numbers in a particular dorm or something like that, they still, by default, it seems, recognize that they are weaker than us, and not just on a physical level. You know, you see it in prison. The dynamic is so easily seen in prison because in prison there's no side dressing, if you will. There's no aesthetic. There's nothing around. Everything is raw. You understand what I mean?
Right.
There's no suits and ties. There's no positions. There's no titles. There's no inheritances. There's none of that at play. Every man is every man. And you see it very raw in prison. They know, and they clearly understand who we are. The problem is we don't. Too many of us don't understand who we are, and we are the prototype on the planet. You know, everyone understands that, it seems, you know. You know, we talk about Europeans and whites, you know, the ones that defect. You know, you see these white women defecting the white race in droves now. You don't want to know why? Because females think different than men to a certain degree. And they know that black males, black people are the prototype, and many of them subconsciously want to be and link up with that prototype. And they don't have the male pride that's going to stop them from doing it. And that's why you see that going on. So they understand. They understand clearly what we are, who we are. You know, the problem is we don't.
I have one more question. So do you believe in the theory of Dr. Creston Wells' book, The ISIS Paper?
Which theory?
The ISIS Paper, what she talks about, where it's always, you know, the sayings, tall, dark, and handsome, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing, chocolates, candies, Valentine's
mm-hmm.
Day, stuff like that. So
you
mm-hmm. are
yeah.
school of that thought?
Most definitely.
Okay.
Most definitely.
I'm done, guys.
Oh, right on. Right on. I wanted to check with Mr. Nero. Good to hear from you, Mr. Hill. He's been caller back from way, way back when it first started in 2009. And Mr. Nero is pretty close as well. He was there from the beginning, or pretty close to the beginning. Mr. Nero, did you have a question?
I'm sorry, is that me, Gus?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry, sir. I'm working. I'm just listening, but I'll chime in later. I'll mute my line.
Okay. Good to hear from you. Let's see. Person that dialed in 4372. There are a lot of people that called in. Unless you all are just listening, which is, you know, no worries. You are spectating, but no worries. If you have a question, press 1, and I'll know to get your line. Person that called in, 4372. Did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Good evening or good afternoon, depending on where you live. yes, my question is, I wanted to know, how did Mr. Booth feel about the imagery that many of the rap artists or hip hop artists who have had stints in jail or are presently in jail, and it seems like, you know, they kind of make their experiences seem like a, you know, like they just took a vacation somewhere, and how that is damaging or perpetuating a lot of the you know, what actually happens in jail, and, you know, what that experience can really do to the individual. So I wanted to know if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, in my book, Why Are So Many Black Men in Prison, I have in chapter 3 a section about that very specific thing that you are talking about. The music, the popular form of music, with our youth, hip-hop, of course, is being used as a weapon for the most part. And we are, we are part of the problem, because so many of us, we're doing so bad, and we have this desire to co-op by any means necessary in order to gain the things that we desire, wealth or what have you. You know, we'll do whatever it takes. And many of us, you know, we just don't care. And you see it play out every day with the music, you know, the subject matter, just even when it comes down to the music itself, the effects, the psychological effects of the beat even. You know, you can break it all the way down to that. And then you add in the commentary that is so pervasive and so normalized now. I mean, it's just terrible. You know, Nicki Minaj, she's the number one female rap artist in the country. And I mean, what does she represent? She represents homosexuality. She represents black inferiority complexes, 1,000 of them. She represents prostitution. And I could go on down the line. You know, what does Lil Wayne represent, the hottest black rap artist in the country now. He represents gang affiliation. He represents drug addiction. He represents ignorance to the fullest. He represents black inferiority complexes. I mean, you go on down the line. And I can't think of, you know, someone may say, well, he also represents entrepreneurship. Yeah. But all money is not good money. You know, and if you are willing to sell out like that, I mean, they use the word sell for a reason, because usually you're offered something in exchange for your principles, in exchange for your morality and stance. If you're willing to do that, then that's what you're going to see anytime, you know, living under the auspices of white supremacy. That's what you're going to see, you know. You're going to see that a lot, and you're going to hear that a lot. So the fact that many of us are willing to sell out, you know, it just speaks to that. You're going to continuously see that. You know, it's just the way it is, I guess. But all we can do is just fight against it in the ways that we can and speak out on it and control our children when it comes to that, and don't let them play into that, because, you know, there's so many of our youth that are out here lost. I deal with them all day, all the time, every day. They're just out here lost. You know, they know more about Lil Wayne than they know about their father. You know, they know more about rap lyrics than they know about their ancestors. You know, so we have to, you know, we have to really attack this in the home, dealing with our own young ones. And, you know, we have to do that first and foremost, and, you know, whatever we can above and beyond that. But it starts in the home with that.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'll continue to listen. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling in, 4372. I had a quick question to follow up on the Lil Wayne. Do you think it's significant, Lil Wayne? You have diminishing his stature and masculinity, and they reference him as Wheezy. I've said before, the only other Wheezy that I've heard is from the Jeffersons. I don't think that's a coincidence. But his last album was released while he was in prison, Greater Confinement, titled I Am Not a Human. Do you think it's significant that he is a relatively dark black male, that white people would use him, you know, to portray all the foolishness and everything, and he's a particularly dark black male?
Yeah, dark black male with long dreads at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's all, you know, psychologically based, if you ask me. You know, it all, there's always a undercurrent of something more meaningful than what's on the top of the surface. When you're dealing with media, when you're dealing with these visuals, that the powers that be know a lot, you know, that they know has a great effect and a large effect on us, especially. You know, yeah, most rap is bought by white people, but guess what? They buy it in perspective. You know, we buy it, many of our youth, you know, that are out here, that are lost, that are growing up in one-parent, single-parent homes and whatnot, in bad environments, you know, they look to these guys for a little more substance than a white kid typically would. And they tend to imitate these artists. You know, in my in my city of Memphis, we have about 15 new blood neighborhoods that have popped up since Lil Wayne has been a blood. You know, and I think that speaks to, you know, a lot when you consider facts like that. And it's not just here in Memphis, it's everywhere. You know, even the nationwide, you know, they will tell you now for the first time since, you know, the whole Crip and Blood thing has been here, there's more Bloods in the country now than Crips. Why? Because of the promotion of the Blood gangbanging lifestyle through the media. You know, Jim Jones and the whole Diplomat crew, they're all Bloods. The whole Cash Money crew, they're all Bloods. Rick Ross is a Blood. I mean, I could go on down the line. You know, so it is having a great, great, great effect on the mentality and the actions of our youth. And we need to, you know, in the home with our babies, individually, we need to, you know, deal with that and just turn the TV off most of the time. You know, you can't even listen to the radio without hearing references, you know, subliminal messages and whatnot. So, yeah, it's a vast conspiracy. That's just what it is. We have to recognize it as such. And as individuals, we need to take care of our responsibilities in our homes and to each one, teach one as well.
I was curious, we're almost at the bottom of the hour. You talked about your experience in greater confinement. While you were in prison, what else did you learn about racism, white supremacy? I spoke with some white people who have been in prison, and they said that, I mean, you get to see white supremacy. I mean, it's real stark. And he talked mm-hmm. about the guards talked about it openly all the time. The white inmates talked about it openly all the time. I mean, he said it. I mean, anybody who's confused about racism, you go to prison, you will get straightened out real quick. Can you talk about more if you learned things that you learned about racism while you were in greater confinement?
Well, when I went to prison, I was not even aware of racism. That's how out of touch with reality I was as a teenager. I went to prison as a teenager. I got out in my 30s. And I was not even aware of racism. That's growing up in a home with a father. I also live with my mother, and I have a big family. And I, as a grown man, because when you're 18, 19, you're grown, according to this law, I was not even aware of racism. But when I went in prison, you know, I felt I had actual thoughts and almost like backflashes or flashbacks or whatever of my ancestors in chains. And that's what I felt. You know, I felt that. I felt that this was a part of me, these chains around me. And that's, you know, that's something to admit and to feel. But I felt that these chains around me, because everywhere we went when we got transported on planes, you know, I've been on planes for 12 hours in chains. You know, I've been in riots, on buses for 2 days in chains. You know, you say something wrong, you get thrown on the ground and put in chains, locked in a room, kept for hours in chains. You know, and, you know, that really gave me some clarification, some real clarification as to who I am and where I am. You know, and it let me know, just flat out, bottom line, that if we're going to throw off the auspices of white supremacy, it's going to take bloodshed. Talking is not going to do it. Over-discussing is not going to do it. Reacting to it in ways that are not physical are not going to do it. It's going to take more than that. And if we don't want to entertain that, and I always talk about continental Africa first, if we don't want to entertain that, then we just need to deal with white supremacy and stop talking about it, because it ain't going nowhere. That's the bottom line, you know. And I saw that clearly in prison. You know, I saw it going into these prisons that are set off in the mountains. It's still South Carolina, no blacks, but the whole prison is black. And the staff, you know, flat-out rednecks. And there's nothing you can do. You're powerless. You know, a lot of us don't understand what it truly, truly means to be powerless. Yeah, we know we're black in this country. We know it takes a lot to get some kind of reaction or something done for anything dealing with us, positive. But in prison, you'll see a whole different level of that, where you have no recourse, you know. And if you are any kind of a man or a real woman, you know, that'll make you think, and that'll make you really understand what your situation is, you know. So it bothered me so much, it hurt me so bad, you know, that I had to do something about it. And that's why I started writing my first book in prison, because I knew I had to tell that story. You know, a lot of us don't understand with how many of us are actually in prison. You've got more black men in prison than the whole city of Memphis. That's including the babies, the whites, the blacks, everybody. Twice as much, actually. Do you know how many brothers that is? You know? And many of us, we don't understand what it's like to be in prison. They have prisons where you can fly airplanes into them, you know, literally, and unload you, and you have hallways that are 2 football lengths long, walking down nothing but chained brothers, chained to each other from the waist, walking down these long halls to be put into concrete pens for selling a handful of crack cocaine that came from a European or non-black nation, somebody who never owned a car, never had a bank account, but now you're doing 20 years for something you don't even understand. You couldn't just half of can't spare cocaine, but you're doing 20 years for that, and get out, and nobody will hire you by law. And this is the system we're dealing with. So I understand clearly what it is. I don't understand why so many of us don't, you know. You know, I understand clearly what the problem is, so many of us adults, that is, that actually know what's going on, and we have, you know, we can study history, we understand what the problem is, but we act like we don't.
Why do you think it took you going to prison to learn about racism? What is it that, you know, you think kept you from understanding, oh, we're on a system dominated by white supremacy? What kept you from understanding that before you went to prison?
Because my parents, I never heard any, there was never any discussion in my households about race. Not one that I can recall. I never heard my father talk about racism. I never heard my mother talk about racism. And I grew up in the worst projects in Memphis. You know, I never heard that conversation. I never was aware of the fact, you know, even though I could see it, but I couldn't put it in perspective of the fact of how powerless black people are, not just in this country, but in the world, on the planet. That was not a part of my understanding. And that's why I chose to sell crack and gangbang and do all the things, self-destructive, ignorant things I was doing. You know, and I, you know, with the youth, I give the youth a pass because they don't know. I know where they've been. You know, I was one of them. I know how you think when you're 17, 16, 15, 19, you know, if you're being misled and you don't have anything around you that's trying to properly guide you and inform you, you know, and that's who's going to prison. These young, you know, people, our young brothers, that's who's going to fill in these prisons up. Like I went to prison at 19, you know, and that's who's serving these long sentences, going at 19, get out in the 30s, 40s, 50s, if at all. For something they should have got probation for, or some kind of consideration, you know. And, you know, so, but our, you know, us, the ones, us in our 30s, 40s, 50s, I don't give us a pass. You know, because by that time you've learned, in my opinion, you've lived long enough and had some experiences on the job. You know, prison was just my experience. Maybe I would have learned about it when I went to work at a corporation or when I went outside of my parents' household and ventured into the world to make a living. I'm sure I would have learned more than I knew, actually. You know, but I didn't get the opportunity to do that. But by the time you're 35, 40, 50 years old, you know, even if you've been raised wrong, even if you grew up a Crip, these gangbanging young guys out here, they don't understand race. They don't really know. That's why they do what they do. If they did, they wouldn't do what they do. If they really understood racism, they couldn't kill another brother because he has on red or because he's from another neighborhood or something stupid like that. They wouldn't have a culture that's so self-destructive. I can take you to neighborhoods where whole neighborhoods don't know anything about racism. They can give you a general conversation about it, but they don't understand it. They're Christian gangbangers, you know. So, you know, we just have a lot of work to do, you know, and I joined the force, you know, I joined the fight to try to help, you know, wake up so many of us, because that's the problem. So many of us are asleep, but so many of us also are willingly asleep. You know, we get up in age and we just sit down, we don't care, you know, we're all for self, we're scared, you know. That's my take on it.
we're about to wrap up. I have one final question before we wrap up. Thoroughly enjoyed having you on the program, and I have two of your books. I also have Getting Out and Staying Out, A Black Man's Guide to Success After Prison. And if you think it would be a constructive investment of your time, we would love to have you back on the program to discuss that book as well.
No problem.
Before I pitch the last question, the folks that called in, I'm going to open your lines up before the hour mark ends. So please mute your line, keep the background noise down if you have a hand up. If you want to call in, the number is 347-215-6071. You should dial in right now if you want to continue listening. If you want to talk, press 1. And the website, again, is fullsurfacepublishing.com. You can get more information about Mr. Booth and his outstanding work. The last question, the number one thing black people need to stop doing, mistreating other black people. That's what you have in the book. And I just wanted to read this section and get you to close out the program with the issue that you feel is most important. You wrote, this is on page 21 of your book,
You were talking about a study that was done by the Department of Justice. They found that nearly half of all murders committed in the country are committed by blacks. It also found that from 2001 to 2005, more than 9 out of 10 black murder victims were killed by other blacks, and 3 out of 4 were slain with a gun. Get this. The study suggested that encounters with criminals who want to rob or assault a victim are more likely to turn deadly for black victims when the perpetrator is black, which is to say that black criminals don't kill or assault white victims as readily as they do black victims. And if you could comment on that, that'll be a great way to end the program.
Yes, I can also see this myself in plain reality. As I said, I've served 13 years in prison. And typically in prison, when you saw violence, someone being the victim of violence in prison, it was 99.9% of the times at the hands of another black person. And, you know, this, it's all about every subject we've discussed and that's in that book. It's all about just us co-opting and assimilating and playing into white supremacy, because that's all it is. You know, we are doing everything that we can, many of us, to uphold the system of white supremacy. And the criminals in the street, who we refer to as the criminals, as I once was, I sold crack to my own people. I gang banged, you know, I've done all kinds of things against my own people, and I never considered doing it to a white person. And if someone had ever brought that up or, you know, challenged me on that issue, I wouldn't even know what to think about it, because it never was a thought. And so many of our youth have the same mentality. You know, they do it without even knowing why they do it. But the bottom line is fear. You know, there's a reason why OJ is in prison right now, you know, to put it just in a way that some people can relate to. OJ is in prison right now because he killed visibly for everybody to see and got away with legally for everybody to see 2 white people. Some people might have a problem with that assessment or what I just said, but guess what? Someone like me that really understood from the prison cell, when I saw him beat the charge, you know what me and brothers like me, what we said to one another, they're going to find a way to get him, because we clearly understand that they would not readily allow someone like him to get away with that and not receive proper consequences, what they consider proper consequences. So, you know, we have to understand we are all we got. We have to love one another and see each other as brothers and not a distant stranger. When you know, my grandmother, my 90-year-old grandmother said the other day, black people don't even speak to each other anymore. You know, and I know that's a generality, but there's some truth to that. You know, there's a grain or more of truth to that. We've got to get back to loving one another, wanting to help one another. If you got something, some knowledge or some advice that could help another brother in their business or in their activities or whatever, give it to them. Don't keep it to yourself just because you feel some kind of competitive way. And I know that's, you know, I'm saying something that a lot of people may not want to relate to, but I see it every day. We hate on one another so hard. We don't want the next black person to get more than what we got, but we find it a comfortable sight to see a white person with the same. We have to change this mentality. We have to better ourselves. We have to know better and know ourselves first and foremost and concentrate on that. Everything else will fall into place.
Thank you again for sharing some of your time and insight. Just real privilege to have you on the program, and I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I really hope people will get a copy. The title of the book that we discussed this evening, The Top 25 Things Black Folks Do That We Need to Stop, a breakdown and analysis of 25 self-perpetuated issues that adversely affect the African-American community. Excellent work, and thoroughly enjoyed having you on the program. I will definitely be in touch about having you back to discuss some of your other writings. And I hope you continue to keep up the efforts, and more of us need to hear what you have to say.
I appreciate it, Gus. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and your listeners. I'll be back anytime you want me, brother.
For sure. I will be in touch. Just look out for my email, and we'll be speaking with you again soon, sir.
Okay. Thank you, brother.
Take it easy. Be easy, and we'll speak soon.
Okay.
Good night. Context of white supremacy. I was going to play Justice's commercial, but my switchboard crashed, so I can't do it. But I did, I think, got everyone online, so you all should be able to comment. I did want to say quickly again, thank you, listener. I don't know if she called in, but the female who did the artwork for the front page, fantastic. Thank you so much for investing your time and energy and skills in putting the artwork together. I think it's awesome, awesome. Way better than anything I could have come up with. I think it's great. A lot of people wrote on my Facebook page that they thought it was very constructive. also with artwork, Justice told me about the images of the white people at the top where it says the problem is white people. She said the images of the white women, she said, oh, that's so gross. And, oh, I don't like that. You should take that down. And, I said, I'm putting it up for a reason. And I said, because, you know, these images are everywhere. I mean, I don't think, you know, it's a single non-white person that could tell me truthfully the images that I have up of those scantily clad racist women. You don't see 50 billion of those every day, every time you go to the checkout stand or turn on the television or whatever else. So, you know, I'm just showing you what you're looking at all the time. But that is the problem. And the white women specifically that I put up there, they were picked for a reason. I can tell you the chick with the racist female with the green makeup that was sent to me by 808, who hadn't called in. She called in for the first time in a while yesterday. She mailed me that photo, so I included it. The white female with the red background with the strawberries in the lettering, that is Coco. That was straight for Tater Pie. She complains about Coco all the time, that white woman is married to Ice-T, victim of racism, and she does a lot of emulating black people. The white woman with the bikini on and the lettering is in flames. I don't know her name. I don't know who that white woman is, but she was on a list. Like, I was searching through Google to get pictures to put on the page, and they had a list of the top 10 white women that black men love. That was the list. And she was on that list. I think Coco was on that list, too. Kim Kardashian, names that you know, a lot of names that you know. She was on that list. So that's why I put her picture up there. And then the other female is Angelina Jolie, and 909 requested that I get her up there snatching children from Africa and all over the globe, that she should be on the page as well. So there was a reason for the females that were selected. They are the problem, and I think it's important that, you know, what I hope is that it will transfer so that when you see those same images 50,000 times a day, you'll be thinking, oh, yeah, problem, problem, problem. I hope that's what will happen. The other thing I wanted to mention, the earlier program today with Sharon Hall, founder of Intermix, the book that was included, Memories of My Ghost Brother, that is a fantastic book. I found that book when I was attempting to really research why it is totally incorrect for non-white people to engage in sexual intercourse with white people. And that book, I wanted to see if this trend held for all non-white people, not just black people. Like, this same pattern for all non-white people when they have sex with white people, it's the same thing, it's not constructive, and I really wanted to be solid about that. And this book, it's written by a non-white male. He has a white parent. He's so-called Asian. This book is set during the
I believe it's set during the Vietnam War, but it's set in Korea. I think I got it. Yep. Bang. That's what it is. And I read this book 3 years ago. It's really good. That's the reason why I remembered it. It's really, really good. It's well written, and it will give you a phenomenal understanding of how white supremacy works. Like it's his, and he's talking about himself. Like it's fiction, but it's an autobiography in fiction. And he's talking about how his dad was a soldier fighting in Vietnam. He comes and how he treated his mom, practiced racism, of course. And they have a, man, incredible scene. He goes to the movies, right? And they have soldiers who there's a base close to this town of non-white people. And he'll go, this young kid, he's telling the story, remembering his childhood. And he goes to the movies with a black soldier, and they go to see Night of the Living Dead, the 60s version. And white people redid this film, right, with Tony Todd. They redid it, I believe, in the 90s. And they go to see Night of the Living Dead, and they get to the end of the film, and the white people, they blow a black male's brains out. Like, that's the end of the 1960s version. And he's sitting next to a black soldier, and the black soldier gets up, and he's mad, and he starts yelling at the screen and cursing, like, no good crackers. And he's just sitting looking at all this, like, wow, this is crazy. And I remember reading that and going, wow, black people are treated terribly everywhere. And my final pitch for why you should read this, there is a discussion of penis length in this book, White Genetic Annihilation. It's fantastic. Memories of my ghost brother. And I actually will check to see if we can get the author to come on the program, because I thought it was great. And same pattern, exact same pattern you get around the world. Sex with white people is way bad. Everybody that called in, your line is open. Everybody that called in and put a hand up. Sorry about that. Mr. Nero, I think I have you. Believe Non Mighty Wick, Pam, 404. Everybody, Mr. Hill, your line should be open.
I did want to make a real quick comment, and that is that I'm sure that your guest may not have intended to give the impression. But I just want to remind people that the white female who is pursuing black males sexually to breed with white males, she has her own agenda, and that's white supremacy. And, you know, that what she's doing is not because she admires the black male and not because she doesn't care about white supremacy. She does it specifically because she wants to lengthen and strengthen the reign of white supremacy. So she's on the same page as the white male. She's becoming much more dominant and much more aggressive. And I think a lot of brothers can testify to that, that white females today are very sexually aggressive and very aggressive because they are now, like, trying to be up there with the white male. They want to actually dominate non-whites as much as he does. So I would just say keep that in mind, that it's not a compliment for a white female to seek sexual intercourse with a black man. It's not a compliment at all, in my opinion.
I agree. I'm so glad the artwork, she has all those white women up front. I love it.
Hey, greetings, Pam, and greetings again to you, Gus. Great show today. I enjoy both of them. And I would be so looking forward to the other caller, to Mr. D'Amico, if you can get him back on, because what he has to say. And if you could talk more about racism within the prison walls, that would be a great show. Also, if he can talk, you know, if he wants to speak on that. But for what you were saying, Pam, about with the aggressiveness of the white female, and like you have said in previous shows, it's also to enhance their genetics, because most of the children, as you said, that produce with white female as the parent, they always end up going the route of marrying white. Mm-hmm. So in the end, their genetics is going to be much greater improved by mixing with non-whites.
Right. And also, you know, they're having infertility problems. So, you know, if she breeds with a white male or she attempts to breed with a white male exclusively, I mean, that limits the chances that increases the chances they'll become extinct. So she's just as concerned about white genetic extinction, even when she's laying in the bed next to that black man. Because I asked some brothers, I said, well, you know, how can a white female, or I just don't ask brothers, I just ask anybody, how can a white female have non-white children and not fight white supremacy and then claim that she loves them or loves you?
That's true.
She certainly knows that it's happening. She knows that she's a privileged member. But yet if she says nothing and does nothing and she has half black children, she doesn't speak out against black children dying and she's got a half black child, and she doesn't speak out against black men being murdered by unarmed black men being murdered by cops, she's got a black man laying next to her, what does that tell you?
She really could care less, because, as you said, most as I said, in looking around and becoming more aware, I'm seeing that the pattern is most children who grew up with a white mother, they always end up going white.
Yeah, a lot of them do.
Chances are greater that they will end up with a white partner. They're not going to end up with a black partner.
Not if she's raising them by herself, which is what happens in most cases, is the male, the black male and the white female do not stay together long enough to raise those children together. And if she is usually the one that raises them, and she's going to raise them to be white identified. And also, some of that, the white female's behavior is her envy and competition with black women.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, when the brother, the guest earlier spoke of, you know, why do you want to hold people down and, you know, why are you afraid of what the black man or the black people would be if you stayed out of the way, there's also this concern on the part of white females toward black females. So I want, you know, keep that in mind, is that some of it has nothing to do with admiration or even the black male. Some of it has to do with her desire to replace the black female as the woman, period, in every male's fantasy and every male's where he desires. She wants to be number one with all white and non-white males. So, you know, what are her issues that she has to, and look at Hollywood. If you look at the names of the people in charge now, what you'll see is you'll see white female CEOs,
mm-hmm.
CFOs, presidents, vice presidents, all kinds of titles. And as soon as you start seeing white women rise up the corporate ladder, particularly in entertainment, you watch the images of black women hit the toilet. So I believe there's a direct correlation between the increasingly invisibility of black women and the increasing degradation of black female images. I believe has a big connection with the rise of the white female in terms of powerful positions in Hollywood and in the entertainment world. So she's got something going on with she's hated black women collectively ever since the white male was raping black women. She's hated black women since then.
Yeah, you're right, because she always knew she was never the first choice. She was just something that he chose to be with in order to lengthen the white race.
Mm-hmm.
But if he had a choice between a non-white and a white female, he probably would most times he would go with a non-white female.
Well, you know, they did during the early days of when they were colonizing this place, the number of black females being imported into the United States was four times higher than the number of white females. So I don't know what that says. I don't take it as a compliment either, but simply you know, they're co-partners. I mean, there's no use separating one from the other.
You're right, because I happened to listen to the rebroadcast of Gus' show with Jacqueline Battalora.
Mm-hmm.
That was at the White Privilege Conference with Gus last year, and what she was speaking of with how it, with the Bacon's Rebellion and with Virginia and Maryland, and how it used to be, how with the class systems and how race was, that's the first time when race came into play, how there was no division between whom they could marry back and forth. But when they start penalizing the men, not so much the men, but the women, the white women, for marrying outside of their race, was when this great big division came about, because children always got the status of the mother. So whatever the mother was free, then the children was free.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting program to listen to. If all the callers out there get a chance to go back and re-listen to that, to see about how with this within the United States and how the part that race played and how it really came into focus and how it came into being as far as how the law is concerned, that as well as Jaime Lopez back in, I believe it was in 2009 when Gus had him on. Those are two great programs that I enjoy going back and listening to.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to check that out. You know, in the second book, we give a lot of detail as to what happened during slavery. And I think the important thing about doing that was to show that the white female's role as well as the white male's role in terms of the level of cruelty and brutality. And the reason I'm emphasizing that is I think it's still a tendency of black males, this is my opinion, to let the white female off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe there's a very big tendency. I believe a lot of it's programming, because that programming is really just it's just off the chain in terms of the images of the white female. And I don't think a lot of black men take her seriously because she is a female. And so it was important to show the level of cruelty that the white female exhibited during slavery, particularly against the black female. And we have some really horrific examples. So I think it's really important to, I think in the earlier show, the brother was talking about how this sister was going off and she went off in the courtroom and this and that, and how her man didn't do anything. He just kind of sat there and watched her. And I think that's part of the programming, that black men have collectively been programmed to think that the black female does not need their protection. And so a lot of times they don't offer it, whereas they've been programmed to think that the white female needs protecting. And so they are very, very quick to come to the white female's assistance because that's what they see over and over again, the helpless, vulnerable white female. But when they see black women are always portrayed in I'm strong and masculine and I don't need nobody. And so I think that a lot of black men, they sit in the cut and sit back because of that programming, they just have been taught that the only person they should be concerned about in terms of rescuing is the white female. And so I think that that's why I see that time and time again and I've even experienced it, where something will be happening and the black man will be remaining silent. He won't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of all that programming. So I'm just saying, I think it's important that the white female and white male become one. Don't make a distinction. Don't make a separation. It's white people. Not white men, it's white people. That's the problem.
You're right, and Gus needs to put the Kardashian sisters up there too with those other women, because they are not a bad example of two trashy old women that are always associated with black males. Their picture needs to be put up there.
Yeah, that's their claim to fame when you think about it.
Yep.
I mean, you didn't hear about them until they, acknowledged that they were having sex with black men. Then all of a sudden, they became some kind of
celebrity.
So a lot of these, same thing with Chelsea or whatever her name is, she's a straight up, in my opinion, racist white female. And she claims that she slept with, what's his name, I don't even remember what it was, some, that rapper, T something or whatever his name is, I don't know. But this is their claim to fame. I mean, and she's as racist. I mean, if you listen to her on the show, I listened one time when she was interviewing P. Diddley, it was so horribly racist the way she was acting. Yet she's accepted because she claims she has sex with a black man, and that supposedly takes her out of the racist category. I mean, why?
It's a past card.
Right, but this is how we think. We think if a white person does anything, they can't be racist. Yeah, so.
As you said, we just need to get, these people are going to be getting more refined with this, because I happened to listen to a show last night, one of those Block Talk shows. His Gus show was off the air because I thought that other interview was going to be on, so I was just flipping through the channels and I came across this show. And it surprised me. They were saying this caller was a black show, and he was saying that during Reconstruction, even prior to, during Reconstruction, he said more black men got lynched over black women than they did over white women. Because, and he said he has a statistic to prove it out. He said because white men were desired the black women and they feel they could have their own way with them. And when their men stepped in to protect them, they got lynched.
Okay,
and he always thought it was because of white women. He said no, he said it was because of more black women, because white men were aggressively going after black women.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That kind of fits in with what we found, too. Was that black men were lynched white men did more raping, but black men did more, you know, suffered, because rape used to be a capital offense,
mm-hmm.
where it was, you know, it was the same as, you know, murdering. It wasn't the same, but, you know, they would kill people over rape, and they were saying how many men, black men, were being killed, but white men were the main ones raping. So, yeah, you know, I agree with that brother, though. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, how clear does it have to be? I know we're afraid. I know we're programmed. But quite honestly, some of this innocence, in my opinion, is false innocence, particularly, like he said, when you're over the age of 40 and you're acting like you don't know that racism is a problem, or that, you know, I don't know. I can't speak for what somebody else is thinking, but I do think it is taking the easy road by not addressing it.
He is right, because when he was speaking the thing with the church, and how blacks tend to be over religious or over sanctified, and he's perfectly correct, because you see it all the time with black people. I see it all the time with my family. They feel by burying their heads in the Bible and hiding out in the church that some or the other is going to immune them and give them some sort of protection from racism, that white people would give them a pass because they spend so much time in church.
Also, somebody said one time that, I think it was the brother that said, black people just want to die. And I think he kind of equated this tendency to cling to religion as a way of just saying, you know, just kind of almost being deaf-minded, or deaf, you know, having a deaf wish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't remember exactly how he said it, so I can't really say it. But I think he tied the two together, black people's tendency to cling to these churches and their tendency to want to die.
Yeah, because it's always, we're going to pray about it. You know, Jesus will take care of it. God will fix it. And it really irritates me, because they want to put everything in some supernatural being is going to come down and do their battle for them. So therefore, because that's what the white supremacy tells them or pushes in the Bible, that leave everything to Jesus. The blood of Jesus will protect you. The blood, everything is in the blood. You don't have to do nothing. While they're running around with their Bible and they're terrorizing and killing and doing all of this foolishness, and you sitting back in the church pew believing that some angel is going to fall out of the sky and going to come to your rescue just in the nick of time.
Good luck with that.
That's what I said, too. Oh, what I was going to ask you, Pam, I don't know if you, are you in Chicago? You listen to WVON Santita's show?
No, I haven't listened to the radio. No, I haven't.
She had a show on yesterday. Yesterday we were talking about homosexual and whether or not gay and lesbian should be allowed to adopt, and she was making the claim that it was great that these people are out there providing a great service for the community, and these children are given a loving environment. And it would be nice that, you know, we should not look at it based on race and mm-hmm. sexuality, that these kids are getting a good environment. I'm saying to myself, I said, no, this is absolutely foolishness.
Mm-hmm.
Because these people give up their rights to be parents. When you decide to want to lay down with the same sex, you are giving up your right for all parenthood. Why should I allow you to take somebody else's child and experiment on them?
Mm-hmm. Again, the influence of the media, you know, people are being programmed to not have any standards. You know, you shouldn't say anything about this. You shouldn't say anything. Everything goes. So,
because on the news they were saying that the five largest economy right now is India, China, Brazil, Venezuela, and South Korea. So we can see where you know the next skirmishes that they're going to be, and these are all very populous countries. The United States is not anywhere, or any European countries is not anywhere in the picture, mm-hmm. but you're going to see their influence
mm-hmm.
in there as they try to manipulate the system, because especially in places like Brazil, because the people in Brazil, they're already confused, the blacks over there who think that they are white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big mess. Yeah. Didn't mean to hog the line. Anybody got
the Where's the brothers? I don't hear them saying anything. I know we had at least five out there.
Well, all right.
because he was speaking of the white identification with the bleaching cream. I didn't know that the biggest killer in Jamaica is the bleaching cream.
Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding? I didn't know that either.
I didn't know that either. They say that's the number one killer is the bleaching cream because you're damaging the skin on your cell layer. I said it's probably not only in Jamaica. It's probably on the continent, too. If you go to the continent of Africa,
right,
you would probably find the same destructive behavior over there.
Right. I think you can get leprosy from, I forget what else, but somebody did an article about it, and I know you can get leprosy from using, but who's to say what's in that cream anyway? Who's making the cream?
It's coming from, they said the cream is coming from West Germany.
Right, so who knows what's in the cream anyway? It's not, white people are not using the cream. It's only non-whites using the cream, so that'd be a perfect opportunity.
It could be arsenic.
Them.
I would not be surprised if they're mixing in arsenic in that lotion.
Or something that will get into their system and kill them. But, of course, bleaching cream is strong enough, so, you know, but, you know, it's just really tragic. Sometimes it's overwhelming when you see the amount of damage less than 10% of the people are doing to the planet. It's just really mind-blowing. And if we can't see that, you know, and I understand that, you know, we're brainwashed, but I do hope that enough black people and non-whites open their eyes, and first thing you do, stop having sex with white people. Like the earlier guest, that kills a lot of confusion, or at least you have the opportunity to become less confused. But when you've got a white parent, how do you ever get out of that confusion? Unless you distance yourself from the white parent. So if you can't, you know, how can you ever really come to terms with it? And she was saying that she's not torn. Of course she's torn. And her whole conversation was basically about, I got to call myself mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
I got to make the distinction.
Yep.
I know I'm not white, but black people think I'm white. White people think I'm black. How can you not be torn?
To me, she's pulling more for the white team. That's what the whole conversation is about, is that she said she's comfortable considering herself mixed, that she is not, she wouldn't want to choose a side, but in a fight that she would choose to be on the black side.
Mm-hmm. And I think she was sincere about that. You know, I just think that, you know, how is she going to do that? You know, I mean, if you're still saying that you're judging people as individuals, you know, then that kind of shows a contradiction, you know. So, but I, like I said, I empathize with her. You know, I think that's a very tough thing to have a white parent and then take a hard line. I mean, you know, what do you do?
That is what we are doing out here. When you go and you bring these children out here, you're laying down making these children, but you don't think of the consequences
mm-hmm.
of what is going to happen in future generations, that these
right.
are the same people who is going to be waging war on your family members.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. Nobody thinks of the consequences. Some people even think it's a cute thing to do, have a biracial child or whatever, a non-white child with a white parent. Some people think that's really cool until they realize that. And I've seen people, particularly black males, who have had a son that looked white, and they couldn't relate to that son. And it seems like it never occurred to them that this son, you know, most men, I think, would want a son that they feel some identification with. And I remember this one young black man who had had a child with an older white female. And he was on some talk show, and he was saying, this was years ago, and he was saying, the baby looks white. You know, I just can't relate to it. You know, I don't see how I'm supposed to raise a white boy. And so, you know, the talk show host said, well, didn't you know there was a possibility that the child would look more like the mother? And it never occurred to him. So I think that possibly could be some of the reason why so many black-white couples don't stay together. Is it's not thought out. It's an impulse.
Yep.
It's a fad. It's opportunity to get status or to be someone that has status. And they don't really think it through. It's a very poorly thought out decision most of the time, in my opinion.
But these are the ones that everyone is looking up to and saying, well, I don't see anything that's wrong with it because you look at so-and-so. They have done it and everything looks like it's working fine, but you're not behind those closed doors and you don't know what's going on with these people. To me, it's not fine. I don't find it is fine because, as you were saying, you're creating people that's going to be competing against my children mm-hmm. and against me because I get resentful when I see all of these so-called mixed-race children
mm-hmm.
because if you remember not too long ago, if you wanted to get a job in a bank as a secretary or in a department store, you had to fit the certain color criteria. Mm-hmm. And if you did not fit that criteria, you did not get that job. The darker skinned people were left to do domestic work.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think there's a lot of resentment toward mixed race people because of what they've represented and because of the feelings of inferiority that we may not admit to, but that they give us, not because they're better looking, but because we're told that they're better, period. You know, and so we assume that they have more privileges, and so it's hard not to have some resentment. You know, so that's just a real trick bag. I just wish we would stop having sex with white people. Just stop it.
I was going to ask to the other callers out there, did y'all hear the speech with Minister Farrakhan and what he was stating about Rihanna and her outfit that she wore to the Grammys?
No, I didn't.
Okay, because it was
on
Facebook.
Yes, that's where I saw it. So Facebook as a weapon, yeah, I saw it there.
And I believe he was right. The minister was very right in what he had to say, because this girl is a total disgrace. If you saw the outfit that she wore, it looks like she had on absolutely nothing. It was a dress, a white dress, with something in strategic places. But she looked like she had on, she was absolutely naked under this outfit, and she wore this on the red carpet. And this is why I think black women like Nicki Minaj and Rihanna, which is Will and Jada Smith, have their daughter emulating that girl. It's a total disgrace.
But you understand, too, that it's probably her quote-unquote advisors. I do believe that a lot of these so-called black celebrities, I believe that they're totally under control of white people.
Of course.
That white people use them to degrade other non-white people. And so Rihanna, Beyonce, all of them, I believe that the young man that says he's not human, I believe that they're all I believe they're all being manipulated and in their confusion. Or they're just the desire for confusion and desire for the money and the rewards. But there's no accident that all these young black female entertainers have such an – most of them have a lot of unsavory reputations, you know. So, you know, it's just all part of white supremacy. You know, it's just, just a tool that they use, you know, against us. What a mess.
The NAACP Image Award is going to be on tomorrow night, so it's going to be the usual suspects will be on there.
Yeah, the Image Awards. I think they gave D.L. Hughley one year. Of course, you know.
Wow. I'm sorry. I was going to say I was tempted to do a program while that was on, just watching. Comment on who's getting awards.
Please,
like, that
good.
Might be interesting.
Do a show. Mm-hmm. If you don't have one scheduled, just do one, like you did for the NBA.
Ooh, goodness. Well, let me take some nerve medicine first. It just gets on your nerves. I mean, just this NAACP, not owned or controlled or funded by black people, and they give these awards to people that just make you just shake your head.
And you pay enough money, then you're going to get your reward, and that's all it is, like Tyler Perry and the Smiths. They've all paid enough money to keep the organization going, so that's why they get rewarded.
Oh, actually, I think the white people that run the organization choose people based on whether or not they benefit white supremacy. I don't know if Tyler Perry does belong to the NAACP and he contributes heavily.
He gave them $1 million last year, and this year he got an award.
Okay. I didn't know that. Wow. We got a lot of work to do, is all I can say. We got a lot of work to do. But the good thing about it is that energy, that spiritual energy that we're putting out there, even if it seems like it's not having an effect, it is. It is. So even if you feel like you're just one person and you can only do so much, whatever you do is contributing to the whole cult. Collective, this is what I believe, collective spiritual energy that black people are going to need to overcome this.
You're right. Because we say what we want about the Arabs and their culture and how they're
patriarchal society, those people are very family oriented. The men are always in charge and in control of their women and their children, and they take care of their household. And this is something that the white supremacy, they want to break up. That's why they want to pump in all that pornography, and they want to come in there and bring their version of democracy and whatever it is to that particular region to get it, just like though they have it in Europe, where women are running wild and doing whatever they want to do, and, you know, head of household, and we don't need a man, and homosexuality is more rampant and out in the open. That's exactly what they want to bring worldwide.
Exactly, because they know if they to dominate people, you have to destroy the culture. And you have to replace their culture with a manufactured one, and you have to destroy whatever religion they had and replace it with whatever you're calling their religion. So you have to destroy their culture, you know, particularly people who are not haven't been fully colonized yet. You got to destroy that. And so that's what they're trying to do all over the world. They're attacking Islam, I think, for that very reason, is they need to conquer that culture. And, you know, they're not going to stop until they're stopped. So even though I speak of spiritual energy, we got to get some real-world mentality. And I don't know what that is, but I know it's going to take more than talking. And I'm not advocating violence. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm simply saying that we're going to have to do something different. We're going to have to, you know, not just talk. We have to do something different and make some real sacrifices.
Right, because the Indians, the so-called Indians over there, they have pretty much co-opted themselves because they don't mind laying down with a white person and getting married to them. They feel as if though it's a privilege to be married to one of them or even having children by them. They have co-opted the Chinese, the Chinese, the Korean, the Japanese. They have all sold out because there are more Asian people marrying to white males than they are any other group, ethnic group.
Yeah. Well, you know, this thing may come to a head, and even some of them may have to open their eyes, I suspect, because I believe white supremacy is in its last days, and that days might mean a century. But I believe that the closer it gets to their rule to end, the more vicious they're going to be. And I think people, non-white people all over the world, are going to start rising up, because the noose is going to get tighter and tighter, and the behavior is going to become more wicked and more unjust. And I believe that people are going to be faced with a choice. They're either going to get up or they're going to die. And I think it's going to really get to that point all over the world. So I suspect that it may happen outside the United States sooner than it's going to happen here, because they got a captive population here. I mean, they did 500 years to mess our heads up and make us totally dependent. So it's going to be a much harder job to get black people free mentally here than anywhere else.
It might happen in the U.S. sooner than we think, because with this census data, someone I believe had mentioned earlier, why is it that the Hispanics have outnumbered the blacks when normally it was there were more blacks reproducing? And to me, it all has to do in their count. Because with the census data and white people and their trickery with their numbers, they have ways, because now in the census, now if you could be a non-white, but if you have a white parent, then who knows how they're doing that counting once they get it back up there to the census headquarters. So they're putting all of these different check-off boxes on the forms, and you're thinking that you're doing one thing, and then you get there and they do something totally different with that check box.
You mean they might be lying?
Oh, please. We all know they always lie to pad their numbers.
Goodness. You know, I just can't believe that. They wouldn't lie to us.
That is why they're so running around here with this immigration bill that they're trying to push in all of these states now, trying to tell people that you have to have at least one American-born parent in order for you to be classified or your children to get American status. Now, I wonder if somebody should go back through the records, like with George Washington and all of these other people, and start throwing them out the country and saying, you know, their immigration status is questionable, and he should not have been president because he was born here, but his parents were not fully American.
Yeah. Hello, is anybody else?
Gus, what happened to your switchboard? Did you drop everyone?
I don't think so. There were, I believe, 4 to 5 people who had their hand up, you know, to talk, and I opened those lines up. I think Mr. Hill, I did get his line open. Mr. Nero, I had his line open. Mr. Nero, are you with us or no?
Unfortunately, Gentiles got me hustling on this plantation this evening.
Oh,
hey,
got it.
Nero.
I thought I did get Mr. Hill and one other person, I think. I think had a line open, but they might have changed their mind. Or the switchboard crashed so early, I'm not sure. Some people might have gotten dropped, so I'm not sure, you know. Can't really tell.
I guess white people have been messing with your switchboard at the two-hour mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It didn't happen for the early show today, but... You know, might be asking too much to have white people's cooperation for two programs on the same day. So,
no, they probably saw your new page. That's probably what did it.
It's great. Dig it. It's great.
Wow. That was a beautiful page, though. She did a really excellent job on that page.
Yeah. So many non-white people that I've met, they have artistic talent. Think it's more of us. Same thing I said, you know, we were applying our skills to solving the biggest problem that's in front of us. I think you would get to see a lot of the brilliance that black people and non-white people have. Because, I mean, that's just the logical thing to do. Like, it makes sense, you know.
And if you're free to be what you are, if you feel, you know, that you can be that without being attacked. Yeah.
You're right about that, because as the guest was speaking earlier about we being the prototype, it is the truth, because white people love fooling around with genetics. Look how they came up with a hairless cat and all of this nonsense that they've done with the crossbreeding of different animals. These people are sick. A hairless cat. Now, who the heck would have a cat without hair?
Guess he doesn't shed. That's one thing that you don't have to do. No shedding.
But that's their covering. That's to protect them from the environment. They're here. Now, you have to keep them indoors when you have a cat with a short hair cat and all of this foolishness that they've come up with, messing around with the genetics of animals as well as humans.
It is special.
Because as you were saying with the lion and the tiger, I would not be surprised if they have them crossbreed somewhere, that they've bred those.
Yeah. I think that's where that Bigfoot comes from. You know, all these sightings of these bizarre creatures, like the thing that washed up on the shore. I forget what country. It might have been California. It looked like it was a cross between a dog and a bird. It had claws and hooves, and it had a dog's body. It was really, really creepy. Had you guys seen that picture?
No.
Oh, man. You have?
I have not.
Oh, man. I'll see if I can find it and send it to you. Oh, it was the creepiest thing. It was like three different – I think it – did it have wings? I don't know if it had wings. I don't remember. But I know it had a dog's body. It had a beak of a bird, I think, and it had – claws or something, and it washed up on the shore. I believe it was the United States.
Oh, like the movie.
God. And you figure it had to come out of a laboratory. I mean, that's what I just assumed. So, you know, who knows what they're creating.
You're right. Because if they can breed human beings, have stud farms for humans, and they can get a horse and a donkey and come up with a mule. Who knows what else they have out there?
Yeah.
crazy. Speaking of coming up with things in the lab, just wanted to get in. To Sunday, we'll have Daryl Bain. He'll be back. He wrote Melanin Apocalypse. We'll be discussing White Odyssey. That's his book about black people taking over, and also Farnham's Freehold, which is a different book by a different white person. But it is also about white people making some sort of disease or germ to kill all of the black people on the planet. That'll be this Sunday, 3:30 p.m. Eastern, 12:30 p.m. Pacific. Daryl Bain should be interesting. Might do that program tomorrow as well. I did want to remind folks, definitely investments for Dr. Kanban. I would love to have him back on the program. If you think that would be constructive, I want to compensate him for his time. $500, that's the goal. And if you invest, just earmark that it is for Dr. Kanban. Not definitely. That is a victim. I would like to support his counter-racist effort. With that, we have 10 minutes left. Feel free to share if you have anything else you want to get out in the last 10 minutes. And I didn't get to play her commercial, Justice. Her blog is justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com. And her email is justice.asap@yahoo.com. justice.asap@yahoo.com. There we go. 10 minutes left, and I'm good. Thank you. Feel free to share.
Oh, just to change their commercial, because I heard now she's playing Sade instead of Beyonce.
Yes, she did not. She said she's not a fan of Beyonce, and she wanted to change it up, something more mature. So, yeah, switched it up.
Okay. But even Sade has issues because she's another one who's good for the cowbell.
Yeah,
Sade, I mean, you should have a crack in your cowbell ringing it for Sade.
I don't have my cowbell, but yeah, duly noted, duly noted.
Yep, another. Isn't she a non-white
white
person
with
white parents?
Black, and she has been involved in white, all-white relations.
Right, and from what I understand, pretty rocky.
Yep. They're all a bit unstable, but she's always identified with the white man,
mm-hmm.
who she's always partnered with.
Yeah. I think you were right earlier when you said that's very, very, I think that's usually the way it goes with
the white
non-white
women who raise these children.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Earlier he was speaking of the Archie Bunker. That's where Archie Bunker came from. It came from that British comedy
they
had, and that's when they brought it to the U.S. It was based on that comedy that the guest was speaking of, the British comedy show.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. I thought it originated here. I knew Norman Lear made it, so I just assumed that,
No, it was on the British comedy.
Mm, okay. You know, regarding that, just real quickly, that Chris Rock made that documentary on hair, and I don't know if everybody agrees or disagrees, but I did not think it was constructive, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't constructive because he appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and he also got some plugs from the major media for the. So to me, right then and there, that's proof that it wasn't constructive in helping black people become less confused. But I think basically it was just basically kind of putting black women on the ridicule block again. That's what I think it was, and I think that's
agreed.
Why. Yeah, degrading black women as though black women are the only ones with hair issues, and I agree that black women do need to do something. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying that, the black male has hair issues, the white female has hair issues, but yet the black woman is always coming up as a subject of conversation and ridicule, as though she's the only one that's got self-esteem issues. So I just fundamentally have a problem with that. And again, it's my litmus test that if the major media is promoting it, if he appears on Oprah Winfrey, right then and there, I know it's not constructive to black people. I know it's promoting white supremacy. And it actually made black women look like they wanted to be fake white women. So,
which is what we are pretending to be anyway when we straighten our hair and color it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all the issue of, you know, of self-esteem issues that rightfully, you know, can be explained. I mean, it's just people acting like it's some bizarre thing. It's not bizarre. It's just another victim of white supremacy. I mean, it's nothing bizarre when you've been told all your life when you're 4 years old somebody puts a burning hot comb to your scalp and
mm-hmm.
burns your skin. I mean, how are you supposed to feel about your hair if that happens to you from the age of four? You know, I think that's a very normal reaction to want to change your hair after everybody's told you, including boys and men, have told you that they don't like nappy hair. So we're not the only ones with the problem. That's what I disliked about it. You know, it's not balanced and it's not truthful.
You're correct about, I don't know if it was you or it was the prior guest that had mentioned about with Madam C.J. Walker and the hot comb, that it might have been a good invention, but it turned out to be a bad thing for us as a people.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been on...
That's in his book. That's in Dr. Cambon's book. Mm-hmm. That's in Dr. Cambon's book, the last book. I read that on the program. It's one of the... it's a key part, but he's just saying that the idea that she had is an example, even though it wasn't constructive, but that idea changed the system. And I thought that was a really profound point in his book, Dr. Cambon.
Okay, because I knew I heard it somewhere.
Yeah. I can say I'm not defending the practice. I'm simply saying that I believe that the reason the media hooked onto it was one more bit of evidence that black women are inferior. You know, just one more bit of evidence that black women are defective. And it wasn't done to enlighten black people. He didn't talk about white supremacy at all, did he? Did anybody know?
Who was that?
Chris Rock in his documentary. Did he talk about white
supremacy?
Oh, no. No.
He joked about black people on our hair. That's it. He didn't talk anything
right.
about what's white people's problem.
Yeah, so as soon as he's on Oprah Winfrey, I know what time it is. Not because of her personally, but just because it's major media. So as soon as I see him on there, I know it's all BS.
But as I've said all along, if Chris Rock wanted to alleviate the problem, he should have started with his spouse. Tell her to get her hair to go natural so that the children could have someone in their home to look up to see that this is how nothing wrong with my hair being curly.
Yeah, well. I don't think he's going to do that because he likes her hair process probably. So what are you going to do?
For her daughters, if I had daughters and I know my daughters had issue, that's what I would have done. I would have done it as a parent, just let them look at me and see, get their idea of beauty from me to see that, okay, my hair is just like my mother's hair.
Mm-hmm.
But your daughter's hair is thick and curly and yours is straight like a European. You're sending conflicting messages to these children.
Yeah. It's all part of that confusion. You know, I don't, you're trying to undo damage that was done from the time somebody was 2, 3, 4 years old. It's very hard to, you got to try, but it's very hard. Especially when they never see anything. Think about it. We never see any hair products, natural hair products for natural black women's hair. You don't see anything. You might see it in a black magazine here and there, but you don't see it anywhere. You watch these commercials with black women with weaves, using white women's shampoo, it just, oh, my God, I just feel like I just want to throw something at the screen because it's like, it's what a psychological assault. They're telling you this shampoo is going to make your hair wonderful, but you got people on, and it's not their hair. And
you're
they're
right.
using shampoo on hair that everybody knows Beyonce doesn't have long blonde hair.
Yep.
So what is that message? That message is so psychologically